Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. You can see this is your normal academic group that shows up well after the bell rings, you know. So we've got over 100 people registered, and they're going to be joining us soon. And Frank said, well, can't we wait a few minutes? And I said, well, I'm going to huff and puff for 5 minutes, so believe me, there's no reason to wait. I've got to go to another to introduce two members of Congress who are going to come here and try to get me in trouble here. So I'm going to get over and protect myself pretty shortly. Good morning. Welcome. Delighted to be here with you. And this is a personal, real pleasure to have a chance to be with the mighty Ernie Moniz, my good friend Ernie, who was helped me through my time in government when he was over at DOE. People who do know me realize what an unusual thing it is for me to be involved in things scientific and technical. I mean, I thought Gigahertz was a French car rental company until somebody told me that wasn't the case. My closest brush with science was a very unfortunate incident when I was in the eighth grade. We had a guy I grew up in a very small town in South Dakota, and I had a friend of mine, his name was Larry Sutton, and he was a big, handsome, stud kind of guy, football player, not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he had lots of girlfriends. And so this was a very good arrangement. Larry had a need for some help, and I needed help in his area of competence, and so we struck it up. We had a chemistry class, and we were making helium one day, and he unfortunately decided to inflate a condom in the class, which got us both suspended for a week. And so that was when I decided that the hard sciences were not for me, and was instructed that I should pursue political science instead. And it's been, there we are. So for me to be involved with a conference on energy technology is a lifelong accomplishment. Ernie, I want to thank you for letting my father be proud again. So. We're really delighted to have this opportunity, and in talking with President Hockfield earlier, I said, we're all used to, through the years, seeing these rather Malthusian charts, you compound anything at 2% per year for 30 years, and you have an unsustainable outcome, right? And isn't that what everybody looks at with these energy charts right now? It's just completely unsustainable. And we say, what in the world, everything will go to hell. And that's the power of mathematics, but it unfortunately never seems to work out like that. And when you ask why, well, there are interceding events, political events, but overwhelmingly, technological events. And there will be profoundly different paths that we cannot at this stage confidently predict with a mathematical model. But we know it's going to happen. And we're going to be on the front end, us in the non-science, political science world, today are going to get a little bit of a glimpse into that. Open the doors a little bit and start saying, what's out there? And when you start talking with people, and we're involved right now in a so-called peak oil study. I mean, that's not the official name. It's kind of the politics that led to it. And it's so the National Petroleum Council, which is a formal advisory committee to the Department of Energy, is undertaking this look at global supply and demand over the next 25 years. And there's a technology dimension to that. And then we're doing the geopolitics. Frank Verastro is heading this up. And when you start looking at, again, these Malthusian calculations, and you say this isn't going to work, we really do need to understand what is going to be changing the picture. This, what you are involved with, is changing the picture. I am so delighted to have a chance to work with MIT because it's the flagship of competence, scientific competence in America, and how it always has been. And delighted to have a chance to be a partner on this conference, and sincerely hope that we can do things together in other venues. I think this is an important thing for us. So thank you. Welcome to Washington. Welcome to this conference. And I say my role in these sorts of events, the central quality of running a think tank is to be superficial, because I get to open things up and I have no role in the real value of the conference. And so my role is entirely ornamental, and that has ended. So my purpose now is to introduce to you the president of MIT. Dr. Hockfield is a scientist who's come up through the Life Sciences Channel. And, of course, this is such a profound revolution inside the world of the scientific community, how life sciences has exploded in the international stage, scientific stage, and political stage over the last 15 years. And I was astounded to hear, you know, that was a third of the engineers are now doing life sciences work, which is really remarkable. And it's emblematic of how profoundly things have changed and why MIT, when it sought to get its 16th president, sought to reach out and get Dr. Hockfield. So we're delighted you're here. Would you get us started for the real content of this conference? Thank you so much, Susan. Thank you. Please join me in welcoming.
If I close this, will it pull the conference to a premature end? Let me just lower this. Thanks, John, for the introduction. I want to thank CSIS and NREL for hosting the symposium. I have been powerfully oversold. I'm going to continue the huffing and puffing for a few minutes before we get to the real content, which will be delivered by Ernie Moniz, who's the director of our energy initiative, with his co-director, Bob Armstrong, and some of the faculty, some of the MIT faculty you'll hear from today. I want just to kind of set the background, and what I do is I tell the story of how I came to the Energy Initiative. When I first started talking to the community at MIT, and the community being the faculty, the students, the staff, and the alumni, I posed the same question again and again, which are, what are MIT's opportunities and responsibilities over the next decade or two? And I was, I have to tell you, pretty surprised that almost unanimously the answer came back, energy. And I was surprised because, first of all, because of the almost unanimity of the response, but then having gotten used to hearing a lot of passion around energy, a lot of rhetoric around energy, I myself hadn't added my voice to those of the masses. But at MIT, what I discovered was dozens and dozens of spectacularly important research projects already going on campus, both with MIT not having a particular visibility nationally or internationally as a place where energy research was happening. Part of the reason for that, I described discovering these energy projects in the nooks and crannies of campus. In the nooks and crannies because the federal funding for energy research has been poor and sporadic. Nevertheless, energy research has continued to go on at MIT at an extraordinarily interesting depth and extraordinarily interesting level. So that survey of our campus community precipitated our energy initiative. We have just launched phase two. And as I said, Ernie Moniz is the director and Bob Armstrong the co-director, and Ernie put together today's forum. As an institution, MIT has a very long history of stepping up to help the nation address the challenges of whatever era we find ourselves. The example that leaps to mind is the Rad Lab, the radiation laboratory during World War II, which developed radar, arguably the war-winning technology. I want to be very clear about what the MIT Energy Initiative is. I mean, much as people are surprised that a life scientist might be MIT's president, and I rush to explain that about a third of our federal funding at MIT now comes from the NIH. So there really is very much bio everywhere at the Institute. But a lot of people carry around in their head a picture of MIT that is an engineering school. It's not simply engineering. Engineering at an extraordinarily high level, but also science. But beyond science, our expertise reaches into the humanities and social sciences. And our energy initiative is not just about science and engineering, which are, you know, perhaps our more classically recognized strengths. It also integrates our abilities and draws on our strengths in economics, in political science, in management, in architecture, because all these strands have to be woven together to develop a sound approach to the energy challenges. This interdisciplinary approach is essential. MIT also has a long history in getting people to talk together across disciplinary boundaries, and the energy problem is a huge systems problem. The problem is going to require both short-term and long-term solutions, and I would say if there was one message that should come out of today's session, it's that the approach has to be multi-stranded. As Ernie and Bob and their group have put together the proposed energy portfolio for MIT, looking at what we're doing well and what directions we would like to move into. They parsed it into three major themes. The first is new technologies for a cleaner future, and understanding that MIT is not going to be able to do everything. What the Energy Council is focused on is solar, on storage, and also on biofuels. In the second category, is improving today's energy systems for changes in the near term, which is, you know, what do we do about today's technologies? How can we make them cleaner and better? And there we're focusing on clean coal technologies, the issues around carbon capture and sequestration, and nuclear power, which has been one of MIT's longstanding strengths. The third theme, called challenges presented by the developing economies. This is certainly something that we all look across kind of the, you know, the topography of the world and see the increasing energy demands that are coming out of India and China. How will those countries frame up these developing communities and their developing cultures and governments? And the places we're focusing there are on transportation and construction. Many people have said to me, well, we hope that MIT will actually stick with it this time. There have been energy panics in the past. The enthusiasm comes up, and then it seems to go away. We feel really quite profoundly that we're in an age which is unfortunately could be characterized as the perfect storm. Not only do we have high prices at the gas pump, but we have other factors that persuade us that this time the problem is not going to go away, either in anyone's mind or, frankly, economically. In addition to high gas fuel prices, there are growing environmental concerns. Whether or not you really believe fervently that global warming is has an anthropogenic a source, clearly we've got to get control of our CO2 concentration in the environment. There are complex intersections between energy and diplomacy and national security. I don't think anyone believes that the issues in the Middle East are going to go away anytime soon. And, of course, as I just mentioned, there's the press of growing energy needs in the developing world. These are not simply new challenges in our mind. They're also new opportunities. What you'll hear today is some enormously exciting approaches to these challenges, tremendous advances that are taking place in critical science and technology. And I think that the passion and rhetoric coming out of, you know, all corners of the nation really give us a chance to accelerate our progress. As I said, the most important message you should take out of today's session is that we need to develop a portfolio of technologies. There is not a single solution, no matter what the many zealots around these issues will tell you. There will not be a single solution. We need solutions, some that are near term, some that we can put into place in a year or two, and others that are going to take us decades to reach. And thinking about the funding for energy research, we really have to think quite consciously about things that will have deliverables in the near term and things that may not have deliverables for another 20 or 30 years. Today's panels are going to look at advances in two critical areas, two of very many, but two important areas, transportation and electricity. And I would argue that the potential advances in these fields provide a very strong argument for concentrated and increased national investment. The first panel on transportation will talk about some really exciting improvements in battery technologies. There are, I don't know, in the last year, something like four new battery technologies that have come out of MIT in the last year. The implications go far beyond transportation. Of course, we're all excited about the potential for new hybrid cars, but I would say that the rate-limiting technology for virtually every alternative energy technology you want to consider is storage. And so this kind of work on batteries is going to be absolutely critical in getting any of these alternative technologies to be economically viable. Fuel cells, really interesting, but again, a technology that is not going to yield in the next year or two, but we need to invest for things that will play out in the distant future. And there's another important possibility that is not going to be discussed today, and that's ethanol as a genetically engineered biofuel. A lot of interest, a lot of, you know, talk around that, and we're interested in working on that also. The second panel is on electricity. It's very clear that we have to get beyond our dirty coal technologies. dirty coal technologies that increase atmospheric CO2. And we have to, again, pursue the full range of technology options in electricity. It includes carbon capture and sequestration. It includes nuclear, which you'll hear about today, and includes solar. There are, of course, many technological directions beyond transportation and electricity that are going to be critical to solving these challenges. I would only draw out one example, construction. Construction was a part of the world that I, frankly, didn't know about and couldn't get very excited about before I was at MIT. And arriving at MIT, I understand the opportunities around construction. Right now, commercial buildings consume about one-sixth of all of the energy used in the Western world. These buildings, their architecture, their models of construction are based on a cheap energy model. This just cannot be. So we've got to move toward architecture and construction models that draw on the new technologies. A huge challenge as we talk about anything, any of the really big technological transformations that we're talking about, is how do we transition to them? These are enormously important and difficult transition issues. We have vast infrastructures that support our current technologies, and changing those infrastructures are going to be capital intensive and are going to draw on policy, economics in ways that we really have to take into consideration as we consider the technologies. At MIT, our institute-wide energy initiative seeks to help develop energy solutions that will integrate science and engineering with economics and policy, because we can't advance the technological solutions without having the policy and economic solutions going hand in hand. You can hear my enthusiasm for these directions, and it's enthusiasm not just because we need to do them now, but because I think there are really clear directions forward. Promising technologies on the horizon are almost in hand. There are enormous opportunities ahead of us to meet the energy needs in new and, you know, frankly, incredibly exciting ways. If we pursue these directions, it's going to be good news for America and for the American economy. And as I close out and let this conference get onto the content rather than the huffing and puffing, I'm going to just kind of leave you with two thoughts. The first is that there is not a single solution. It will not be a one-size-fits-all solution for this kind of problem. It's not going to be the approach that was used so effectively in this country in the race to the moon or for something like the Manhattan Project. The enthusiasm behind this and the national support for this is going to have to be equivalent to the moonshot or the Manhattan Project. But we're going to have a different, fundamentally different strategy so that we can pursue many different strands. The second, and this is something we take very seriously at MIT, and it's going to be absolutely critical, is the progress is going to require collaboration at every step of the way. On campus, our energy initiative brings together faculty from all of our five schools. So we get people from the Sloan School of Management, the School of Architecture, the Schools of Engineering and Science together to solve these problems. But it's going to require collaboration between the government and the academy and new kinds of collaborations among the great trio, government, industry, and the academy. The enthusiasm, and excuse me for the pun, energy at MIT that's motivating our energy initiative echoes the enthusiasm and energy around the country. And it really is our challenge to transform that energy and enthusiasm into real products, into technological solutions that will be in partnership with policy and economic solutions that will make these technological miracles real features of our world in the days to come. At MIT, we're looking forward to engaging our partners here in Washington and around the country and the world as we do our best to help address the energy challenge. Thanks very much again to CSAS and NREL for hosting the conference. I hope that we'll be able to help you understand a little bit more about what the possibilities potential is in the years to come. Thanks.
Thanks, President Hockfield. That was terrific. If I could ask the first panel members to come up to the front. I'm Frank Verastro, Director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS, and since we are in Washington, just a few obligatory announcements. Get that started back. Washrooms are out the doors to your left for evacuation purposes, since we are one floor below street level. Exit signs and stairwells are just behind the elevator banks, and it is one floor up and exit on the street side. For the courtesy of those around you, as well as for the speakers that have traveled long distances, if you could turn off your cell phones now, we'd also greatly appreciate that. Let me just say this morning, it was in Dr. Hamry's remarks, but he told stories about his college days. This is the third installment in a series that we started and envisioned really kind of last year when we talked about alternative fuels and challenges going forward. We've had sessions on biofuels. We will continue to do that. We are co-sponsoring this series with NREL, the National Energy Renewable Laboratories out in Golden, Colorado, and the Global Strategy Institute here at CSIS, as well as the Energy Program. When we first got into this, we knew that there was an important facet both on the transportation side but also in power generation as we look to electric cars. The more we get into this issue, the more we see a need to go on further sections. So we're going to be doing adding to the series and looking at installments on other alternative fuels. We'll do an expanded view of the biofuel sectors. We'll look at unconventionals and carbon fuels, coal to liquids, gas to liquids, but also look at automotive technologies, other energy-saving and efficiency devices, and then the session we're having this morning is on emerging technologies in terms of energy development. For our panel this morning, we've got Ernie Moniz, as John has indicated, who is well-known by this audience in Washington. He's the former Undersecretary of Energy. He's also co-director of the Energy Laboratory at MIT. And we are recently, among other things, Ernie has testified many times on Capitol Hill on energy policy issues. We're working on a Council on Foreign Relations study, which he informed me this morning. The topic and title has changed over the weekend since the last draft we had seen. It's due to be released next Tuesday, so a nice time to tell people that worked on it. But the focus is on energy and security and foreign policy, and the transportation sector is a driving force behind that. So let me turn the podium over to Ernie to give some opening remarks, and then we'll introduce the panelists and get started on the presentations. Thanks.
Thanks, Frank. Yeah, I'll go up there in a second. I should not be thought of as part of the panel as opposed to part three of the introduction. What I want to do is really give a few more specifics along the lines of Susan's remarks in terms of setting up what will be a selection of some of the important technology portfolio options as they apply to the major energy challenges. So I think if I'll move up here, perhaps. Susan mentioned already that there are, and I think as you all are aware, really three major challenges that come together: the whole supply and demand picture, the security considerations, and of course environment, most especially the challenge to our fossil fuel dominated energy system that is posed by the risks of climate change. Now, there are various responses. And supply and demand, again, there are efficiency and behavioral issues. This is one particular New Yorker reference to the kinds of options we have to face in choosing perhaps more efficient approaches. A mere two slices of toast at a time can actually dramatically affect our uses in our homes. Security, just a reminder, a focus, and this is setting up really the first panel, that when all is said and done, really the core issue in considering at least the oil questions in security is that our transportation fuel sector is fundamentally inelastic in its dependence upon a commodity oil that has some unfortunate geographical and geophysical realities attached to it. Now, there are a variety of responses, technology and policy. We are going to focus here on the latter. And so if I go down to the bottom of the slide, weakening the, as the president has now introduced, the addiction issue, there are a variety of technology pathways, efficient vehicles, alternative fuels, and new transportation paradigms where one might think of electricity in various forms with batteries and fuel cells as an alternative fuel. And, in fact, our panel, John Haywood, who has really done some of the leading work in, for example, in life cycle analyses of vehicle technologies and efficiencies, Gerhard Sater in terms of batteries and Yang Xiaohong in terms of fuel cells will provide a snapshot of where are we today, what is the promise going forward for these technology pathways. And again, there will be many options. We can't cover them all. This is, for example, a picture of John Haywood's students with some of his advanced high efficient vehicles. But he will, I think, offer a few other examples as well. And then finally, in terms of climate, this is just a kind of a cartoon indicating the global carbon cycle. The message here really is that we are roughly two-thirds of the way to a benchmark, doubling pre-industrial CO2 concentrations, that is doubling two-thirds of the way from zero, if you like. And if we think in terms of a budget, a cumulative budget for carbon dioxide emissions, the way we're heading now, we'll basically break the budget just after mid-century. So given the fact that the energy infrastructure is so capital-intensive, turns over so slowly, basically it says we have to start changing the direction essentially today, and that will be a challenge. And in fact, if we look then at this is a complicated table, but there will only be two numbers to look at. This is a picture of U.S. Emissions of carbon dioxide, and two numbers stick out at you. One is on the top line, petroleum and transportation. That's, of course, the issue we've already discussed in a kind of a security context as a major emitter and a major potential growth in emissions of carbon dioxide. But the other one is down on the line called electricity and residential and commercial. That is what President Hockfield referred to. Buildings, first of all, are an enormous 75% of our electricity goes in there. Coal is a huge source of our electricity, and that, of course, leads to huge CO2 emissions. This basically tells you, just like Willie Sutton decided to rob banks because that's where the money is, if you want to control CO2 emissions, the first two places we look are transportation and carbon-free electricity. So that's really the second part of the agenda today, where three different carbon-free electricity pathways, nuclear, solar, and carbon capture and sequestration, will be the subject of discussion. And finally, in framing it, I'd like to emphasize, in a certain sense, quantitatively, what President Hockfield referred to as the need for a portfolio of options. Now, one might say, well, that's just these research people who want to work on a lot of different things. They like all kinds of different toys. It's actually much, much more than that. This is an example, and the details of the scenario aren't the issue. This is a particular MIT economic scenario of global primary energy over a century, which clearly nobody can predict. This is not a prediction. It's a response of the global economic system to, in this case, carbon pricing. The point is, what this shows is a scenario that, in fact, addresses that perfect storm of challenges. It stabilizes carbon dioxide at twice pre-industrial. It provides a lot of alternative fuels to address the security issue. And it lowers, from the top of the gray bar to the top of the green, it lowers demand by about a third over the business-as-usual projections. So this is a scenario that works. What's in the scenario? In this scenario, as you know, often we tend to lurch in this country from one silver bullet to the next. A few years ago, all the discussion was hydrogen vehicles. Does anyone ever hear that anymore? Today, it's ethanol and carbon sequestration. Some years back, it was syn fuels. The point is not that any of these were bad ideas. The point is, as I will try to emphasize, is we need them all, and we need to have a much more consistent, sustained portfolio approach to these technologies. This is brought out in this scenario. In this scenario, the green is biofuels, and this crosshatched pink area is carbon sequestration. As I say, two of today's favorite silver bullets. As I said, this scenario works, but there's one major issue. It's called scale. That biofuels contribution corresponds to 50 million barrels per day of biofuels. That carbon sequestration contribution corresponds to 200 million barrels per day of carbon dioxide injected into geological formations. Neither of these violates a law of physics. But think about trying to get that scale issue resolved. So the point is, the scale of the energy system is so big that it's very unlikely that any silver bullet is going to solve our problem in efficiency, going to solve our problem in alternative transportation fuels, or is going to solve our problem in terms of carbon-free electricity. So, for example, that little yellow bar, nuclear, it probably has to grow substantially to take up some of that load. That little blue bar, renewables, photovoltaics, it's got to grow a lot. We need a portfolio of carbon-free solutions. That green biofuels, it will be, I believe, a very important contributor. But we probably also better have some electricity in that mix with battery, with new batteries and new fuel cells. So it's really a very quantitative point that our energy infrastructure is so large, so capitalized, so expensive, and runs into so many constraints in resource use, in land use, in underground use, et cetera, that we need this portfolio, and we have to reorient our thinking and our support of technology development in this portfolio sense. So that really is my remarks, and hopefully provides context as to why these kinds of snapshots that you'll hear today in terms of various, not all, but many of these key technology areas will hopefully be useful in your thinking going forward, whether you are a technologist or a policy person. And finally, I'll end with, I'm sorry, I forgot to go through all of these little fine things, and I'm going to skip all the messages and the credits and finish with this. John Haywood is a great man who will talk about these technologies of oil-based, electricity-based, but frankly, here's the real action. This is now a new freshman class where they're out there measuring, actually, energy use in alternative vehicles. And I think this is a very important concluding statement. As Susan Hockfield mentioned, the resonance on campus has been enormous. The students are wildly excited. Every serious energy event is an overflow event. And I think that's an important message. We've got to listen to the students. They really think this is an important place for them to think about using the new tools, whether they are nano, bio, info, or others, on energy and environmental problems. And they're voting with their feet. They're taking these new classes. And I think that's a very, very important and hopefully quite positive development. So with that, again, I hope I provided some context. And I think we should go to Frank and just get into the first panel. Thank you.
Ernie, thank you. Because we have a lot of ground to cover this morning and Dr. Hockfield and the panelists have an appointment on Capitol Hill right after lunch, we're going to, thank you, move right on to the presentations. Our presenters for this discussion include Dr. John Haywood, who's director of the Sloan Automotive Laboratory and professor of mechanical engineering at MIT, Dr. Gerbrand Sater, who's the R.P. Simmons professor of materials science and engineering, and Dr. Yang Xiao Horn, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at MIT. Expanded bios of all of these presenters are in your packet. I would urge you to read them because this is an extremely talented and impressive group. We're going to try to ask the speakers to limit their presentations to about 15 minutes so that we can allow for adequate time for questions and answers and discussion. And like all presentations here at CSIS, with the permission of the panelists, this is all on the record, and we'd like to be able to post your presentations later on our website so it's available to everyone. And with that, Dr. Haywood, would you please start? Thank you.
SUVs and vans, because that's the big piece. It affects us all individually as well as collectively, and I'll run out of time if I try and do lots more. A bit of background, and I think it reinforces what Ernie Moniz was saying. It's really hard to appreciate the scale with which we use energy, in this case in transportation. The numbers are unimaginable. In the U.S., in transportation, for every person, we use 3 gallons a day. Now, is that a lot? In transportation, 8 or 9 gallons a day overall in terms of energy consumption. Is that a lot? Well, if you look at the size of a gallon, it is. So I've got some numbers here. The scale is vast, and the growth rates of 1% or so a year compound substantially over 25-year periods. What's special about transportation is that it's monolithic in terms of its technology. On land vehicles, it's internal combustion engines. Aircraft, it's gas turbines, jet engines. And we all use petroleum-based hydrocarbon fuels. Those fuels are fantastic in terms of energy density, so weight and volume are the best there is around. No wonder we are, in a sense, addicted to petroleum. Now, why is it monolithic? Well, it's important to understand that, and it's because over decades, as our transportation systems, which have many pieces, as they have grown up, they have obviously evolved so that they're well-suited to the task, which is providing travel and transporting freight as effectively and economically as possible. It isn't just economically, it's as effectively and economic. The gasoline engine in your car may not be the most efficient engine that you could have, but for what you pay for it, it's very effective and very robust and gives us cheap transportation. Let me say a bit about the individual technology areas to give you some flavor and then put this into the context of the evolving U.S. fleet. And it's important to think at both the vehicle level, what can we do at the vehicle level, and then how does that all compound in our vast transportation fleets out there. So let me run through this list and say a bit about each. The technology gets better all the time. There's a widespread feeling that internal combustion engines, that's my specialty, by the way, internal combustion engines are old hat, they're already there, they're fully developed, and they're not going to get any better. That's all wrong. As we invest more in learning how they operate, what their problems are, what their opportunities are, and improving the technology, incrementally they get better and better, and some of our studies suggest they get better in terms of performance and efficiency, at the order of 1% or so a year on average. That's not bad when you compound it over 20, 30 years. So the technology is getting better all the time. The question is, what do we do with that? And I'm going to come back to that because that's a very important issue. So gasoline engines, typical automobile engines, are steadily getting better, and they have. And there's a long list of things that we can do to improve them. My own lab, the Sloan Automotive Lab, is doing research on that, and that connects me and my colleagues sort of well with the technology and the industry that produces these engines and vehicles. Diesels, in some parts of the world, diesels have displaced gasoline engines, like in Europe, because there are the strong economic incentives through different fuel taxes. Diesels are also getting better, but to be honest, they're dirty. Go to big European cities, you can tell they've got lots of diesels. You don't get that sense from U.S. Big cities. We can clean up the diesel, but it raises the cost. And, of course, hybrids are one of our favorites these days. If you're willing to spend a few extra $1,000, you can get a significantly better fuel consumption. But is it worth the cost? In straight economic terms, at present, no. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. And we're discovering whether hybrids have really got a large market. They're slowly growing. We'll find out because they're out there in the marketplace. What they have to do is become cheaper as well as, if you like, make it clear they are robust. This market, transportation, requires very robust and, let's put it in quotes, cheap technology. Transmissions have steadily got better. Go back to the early 1990s and a three-speed American automatic transmission. It was a lot worse than you realize. Now, in the succeeding decade, they've got a lot better. How many 5-6-speed transmissions are out there? And we've got some new versions that are coming into production that are more efficient still. So we're well on a path to making improvements there. And we've reduced vehicle weight. Drag is down, aerodynamic drag, better tires. All these things happen bit by bit by bit. And maybe in this first area, there's the order of a 30% improvement at the vehicle level over 20, 25 years. It's potentially feasible to improve the fuel consumption that much, provided we decide we want to do it. Alternative fuels. Well, we're seeing coming into the transportation fuel arena fuels made from oil from the very viscous tar in the oil sands in Canada, heavy oils in Venezuela are starting to be used and elsewhere, gas to liquids in some places like Qatar, we're converting natural gas, which is to some extent stranded, to liquids which can be used in transportation. We've got massive oil shale reserves in Colorado. We'll be digging that up. Coal, we can convert that to liquid hydrocarbons, but the greenhouse gas consequences of that do not look good unless we find different ways of going from these what we call non-conventional petroleum sources into transportation fuels. A bit about biofuels, because that's important. Two years ago, I started a PhD student who wanted to work in this area looking at the long-term environmental impacts. What does 50 or more years of growing biofuels on a large scale do to the land and water resources in this country? People weren't that interested 2 years ago. Boy, are they interested now. We're on a rising tide, and my poor student gets told, please do this and that and add this to your project, and so we raise our eyebrows and say, all right, let's keep this under control. But biofuels are going to come and provide a very important cushion, but it's not yet clear what the costs will be. We need to develop the technology that will do it much more effectively, and we've got to look at some of the long-term environmental impacts if we do this on a very large scale. So the biofuels industry has got off to a pretty good start, but it's got to change before it can grow much more. And then finally, of course, we've got fuel cell technology and hydrogen. We've been working hard on that. The government's got a big Freedom Car and Fuels program. We used to think that was a sure thing. Now we're a bit more cautious. There are a lot of technical challenges. I get asked, will hydrogen happen? It's the wrong question. These really big questions, we can't answer them. We've got to break those down to what should we do next? Where are the bottlenecks? Hydrogen storage. What can we do about it? What does the science and engineering have to offer us in terms of new ideas? It's those kind of questions that matter. It's too early to say, yes, we will end up in 2075 with hydrogen-powered vehicles and a hydrogen fuel distribution system. We don't know. But it's important that we find out how good that opportunity might be. The same thing with electricity. Plug-in hybrids, where you have a battery electric vehicle, but you've got a small motor on board so that when you reach your limited range, you can still drive the car. That's a very interesting concept that will get looked at. It needs better battery technology. We're going to hear about that. And, of course, everybody wants clean electricity, including transportation. Is there enough to go around? Now, just a couple of minutes on this chart, and this will draw out my conclusions. We are doing a lot of simulations of the U.S. light-duty vehicle fleet. So this graph shows on the vertical scale what's the annual gasoline consumption of that fleet. And today it's 560-odd billion liters per year. You and I have no idea what that number means. It's gigantic. Calendar year is on the bottom, and we're at 2006. One of the things I discover with these studies is that real time goes faster than our progress at dealing with this. I started in 1998. We chose 2005. Let's choose 2005, seven years away. We should be implementing some of these ideas by then. We're now at 2006, and we haven't started implementing many of these ideas. So we got to watch it. The top curve is no change, growth in fleet, growth in miles traveled, no improvement in fuel consumption, and that goes steadily up at an alarming rate. And by 2035, we'll be up in the sort of 800-odd billion liters of gasoline per year. The yellow bar is what we will get through the improvements in mainstream technology, mainstream engines, transmissions, vehicle materials, drag, etc. We made a critical assumption in that yellow band. Half of the fuel consumption potential goes into fuel consumption. The other half goes into increased performance and larger and heavier vehicles. The last 20 years has seen the order of a 30% improvement in vehicle efficiency go into higher performance, larger vehicle size and weight. There hasn't been an improvement in fuel consumption. So history says zero. The maximum is 100% of the technical potential. We've assumed half. If we get 100% of that potential, that yellow band will double. It's already the biggest band there. If I double it, it's enormous. And that tells us something. Improving the technology in almost all of the vehicles that are sold is a really good idea. A 15, 20% improvement in 90% of the vehicles outdoes a 40, 50% improvement with a hybrid in only 15% of the vehicles. So volume matters enormously. The red band is what hybrids, diesels, and advanced gasoline engines, we're seeing some highly boosted engines coming out now which match what the diesel's doing, useful, but it takes time to get these new technologies out there into the marketplace. There's a sort of 10, 20-year lag time. The light blue is interesting because it looks really fat early on. Suppose we impose a substantial increase in gasoline tax to replenish the highway trust funds so we can fix our deplorable state roads and bridges and perhaps expand our road system. If we could cut the mileage growth from its roughly 0.5% a year to zero, we'd get that blue band. It's the biggest piece in the near term on that graph. We should think about that. And then finally, if we cut growth in sales, we do better. So let me end there, because those are the conclusions. But the most important one is that we've got a lot of opportunities, but we have to decide, do we use them for improving fuel consumption, or do we put it into higher performance, larger vehicles, heavier weight? It's our choice as consumers, if you like, regulators, and industry contributing to this. So I'll end there.
Dr. Hayward, thank you very much. Thank you. Dr. Sater.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. I'm here at Sater, and I'm going to tell you a little here about batteries this morning. One of the points that I want you to come away with is that if you look at the advanced battery industry, it does not care about HEV. It cares about the things up there, the power electronics market. That is the only market for high-tech batteries. It's about a $4 billion market. It is completely built out of one chemistry. It is lithium cobalt oxide chemistry. That's what's in your cell phone and what's unfortunately also in your Dell laptop. It's expensive. Cobalt is expensive, and there are known safety issues with it. So if we are going to put high-power batteries, and I'm constantly going to use the distinction between energy and power, and my apologies for my persistent willingness to enforce to teach you something, but I really want you to understand the distinction between energy and power. Energy is about how much energy you store in a battery. In all the new applications we're going to talk about, energy is part of the issue, but power is the big one. It's how fast you can charge and discharge. If you talk about these new applications where you need batteries, the big one being HEV, but probably the transition market will be power tools, and then the ultimate market, which is backup of large-scale electricity, these are all high power. They are high power, and if you can get high energy with it, that would be great. But it's all about very fast charging and discharging. This will not be your father's Oldsmobile, as they say. It will not be your laptop's battery. Okay? You cannot put current lithium-ion technology in a large-scale battery like an HEV. You would essentially burn them to the ground in no time, and we don't want that. To give you an idea of what has already been achieved, you can now buy a power tool with lithium-ion batteries at from Black & Decker that has more power to drill screws in the wall than a corded tool. So the battery device has essentially surpassed the stuff you get out of the wall. That are the kinds of power rates you can achieve. Currently, the market has still very little interest in it. This segment of the market is below $1 billion, if anything at all. This is about $4 billion and growing rapidly. Everybody's essentially waiting for lithium ion to take off here. At 3.5% market penetration of HEV, you are building so many batteries that the market in HEV for batteries is much, much larger in dollar volume than the electronics market. Nobody knows where that ends. Once you're at 10% and so, you're probably at a $20 billion market. But it's all high power. There's a large battery activity at MIT since 1995, using all kinds of tools from molecular chemistry, nanotechnology, to high-level theory and computational modeling to design better electrode materials. And there's really been an enormous basic science push in batteries from, it used to be if you worked on batteries that was the low end of the totem pole in academics. Life has changed, I can tell you. Now these days, we used to all work on electronics. These days, it's all HEV. HEV is where the market potential is. So let me briefly tell you why HEV makes sense. Even if you went back into the 1900s, if you designed a car, if you had the ability at the time and the tools and the technology, you would have designed an HEV because it's essentially a power buffer. Just for those of you who are not familiar, an HEV is essentially a normal powertrain, a normal internal combustion engine with a battery plus electric motor to do both a power assist in acceleration and to capture energy from regenerative braking. So what are some of the benefits? Because you have that energy buffer, there's quite a few things you can do. You can assist in acceleration. One of the points I'll make also towards the end is electric motors have very high torque at low RPM. And this is where your internal combustion engine is poorest. We all want to go out and buy a 200-horsepower car. That's not to drive on the beltway. Not that you drive really on the beltway anyway, but we want that horsepower to accelerate. Most of the time, we don't use that horsepower. And internal combustion engines are notoriously bad at low RPM. That's why you need enormous horsepower to make it 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. Electrical motors have torque essentially from the start. 0 RPM, you start torquing, you can have an enormous output. So the fastest street legal car in the U.S. is now an electric car. Okay, 0 to 60 in 3.5 or 3.6 seconds. It's not a Prius, though. But the other good thing is that if you have a power buffer, you can capture energy. So you can capture the braking energy, regenerate it, and actually get it back into the vehicle. In full hybrids, which only Toyota and Ford make at this point, you can also drive full electric for a short amount of time. So if you get out of the, you leave from the stoplight, you can up to 20, 30 miles per hour cruise full electric. This is important because it shuts down your engine. Your engine is completely shut down. So you've just killed the two biggest efficiency losses in city driving. In highway driving, it's air drag and tire resistance. In city driving, it's stopping. You dissipate the kinetic energy of the car in braking, and it's the friction losses in the engine. If you can shut down the engine as much as possible, you'll win there. If you can capture the braking, it's kind of like getting a perpetuum mobile. You just capture it, and then you use it when you start up again. It's not perfect yet by no means, but that's really the idea. And that's why the hybrids were essentially the first cars that ironically had better mileage, gas mileage in city driving than on highway driving, which is actually a little surprising when you look at the numbers, but it's because of this, because you essentially kill, your efficiency is largely in those things. And that's why, one of the reasons, by the way, why there is so much confusion in the press about what the real fuel efficiency is of a hybrid. It depends enormously on the type of driving you subject it to. If you do only stop-and-go driving, the fuel efficiency is extremely good. If all you're doing is cruising on the highway at 70 miles an hour, you're not going to gain all that much. Where are the cost challenges? You need a battery and an electric motor, and you need power electronics. You're running these things at 500 volt, 300 to 500 volt. These things are expensive. So those are things you lose, you have to pay for. Where do you win? You can work with a smaller engine. Because if you can get power assist from the battery, you really don't need the 200 horsepower in the IC engine, because all you want is for acceleration anyway. So that's where you gain. I want to give you a sense of the technical challenges here, because they are significant, but they can be met. Roughly $1,000 will buy you about 1 to 3 kilowatt hours of energy storage. To put that in perspective, you know, a Prius now has about 1.5 kilowatt hour battery on board. It uses a somewhat older technology, slightly more expensive, but you are in the right ballpark here. What I want to tell you is what that can do for you. You know, if you take a 3,000-pound car, you break it from 40 miles per hour in 10 seconds, that's a 24-kilowatt charge rate. Now, maybe the numbers don't tell you something, but that's equivalent to taking a battery that's empty and fully charging it in 2.5 minutes. Obviously, we're not nearly there. You know, if you plug in your laptop, your cell phone, it charges for about 2 hours. So it essentially charges and discharges at a very slow rate. Battery technology needs to improve charge-discharge rate by these two orders of magnitude to reach these very high charge and discharge rates. And you want that back, huh? Because on the discharge, you want enormous amounts of current so you can accelerate. You want to accelerate as fast as possible, which means you want to discharge that battery in, you know, 10 to 20 seconds if you can at all. The good news is here that if you liked hybrids today, you will like them a lot more tomorrow. And the reason is battery technology is not nearly there. You know, if you look at a Prius, it probably doesn't capture more than 20, 30% of all regenerative braking energy. And it already gets fuel efficiency out of that. If you can charge at much higher current rate, okay, you know, the average braking cycle, according to the Department of Transportation, is 15 seconds. Mine is like 5 seconds, and I think most of you is lower than 15 seconds. That's an enormous power rate that you have to put in the battery. So basically what NIO has done is that's stopped off. A lot of that energy gets thrown away because we can't charge the battery fast enough. So if you can make higher charge rate devices, you will have significantly better fuel savings. And if you're not ecologically minded, look at the other side, you will have significant higher performance, significant higher acceleration assist. So what's done now? All hybrids have nickel metal hydrides battery in. One of the reasons was Toyota started us down that path for, I think, very strategic reasons. It was a very comfortable choice. Toyota was engineering a very, very complex technology and wanted to take no chances on the battery. So they went with a very known technology, nickel metal hydride. Panasonic had been making large battery packs. They could just buy them and put them in the car. They're expensive. They're essentially already bottomed. You're not going to see much cost reduction in nickel metal hydride because it's essentially a materials cost problem. The component of the metals is rather expensive. They're large battery weight and volume, and they're mostly manufactured in Japan, which is an issue for U.S. car makers. If you don't believe me about the size, open up the trunk of your Prius. The first thing that happens when people who go into a showroom and want to buy one is that they turn away when they open up the trunk. There's a big battery in there and not a lot of space anymore. So that's a problem that has to be fixed. The future generation is absolutely lithium-ion. Essentially, the decision has been made at major car makers already to go lithium-ion. It's much higher energy density, so you can make smaller batteries. You can do very high power, and I'm going to show you that. And it's actually also less expensive in high volume. That is something that most people don't realize. Lithium-ion is expensive now because it's put in your cell phone and laptop where price is not a driver. Your cell phone battery already costs less than a dollar, and your cell phone costs $200, $300. There is very little interest in making that battery cheaper. When you not talk about HEV, there is a driver to make it cheaper. How does a lithium battery work? This is important to understand where the improvements are going to come from. It's essentially a shuttle device for lithium ions. You know, all you do is shuttling lithium between an anode and a cathode, and I'm sorry for the technology here and the science, but where the limitation really comes from is that you have to store lithium on both sides, on both electrodes, on discharge, You store it by inserting it literally in the crystal structure of a material. You take a material and you shove it full of lithium ions, and the more you can shove in, the more energy you can store. The faster you can shove it in, the more power you can get, because the more faster you can move that current. And so what we essentially do is very simple. We look for materials here that are cheap, non-toxic, safe, and that can move lithium and electrons at enormously fast rates. We do that at MIT computationally. We use good old physics and quantum mechanics, so our ideas at least are based on something, and actually try to come up with materials for very high energy and high power. And here's an example. You know, this is a discharge curve. This is your typical C rate or C over 2. This is how your cell phone would discharge. But we can go up to 6C, and just, I don't, if you're not familiar with the nomenclature, that would be discharge in 10 minutes. Okay. So you could charge your laptop in 10 minutes without any loss, significant loss in capacity. But we can do better. I already told you that IC, internal combustion engines, only reach high power at high RPM, unlike electric motors. So I'm going to show you what we can engineer in terms of materials, in terms of what I call extreme rate. Now, here's lithium iron phosphate, which is an extreme rate material. It used to be a really bad rate material. There's been a lot of work at MIT by myself and some of my colleagues, Yetming Chang and others, to make that very high rate material. This is a material with the capacity almost the same energy density as your cell phone battery. It discharges in 1.5 minutes, which means you can also charge it in 1.5 minutes. If you do the numbers, a 6-liter battery, that's a bucket of battery, will give you 130 kilowatt. If you plot that on an acceleration curve, that's 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. So I think you can have your cake and eat it too, and I think this is important. We have sold probably as many cars as we're going to environmentally minded people. We're also going to have to sell cars to people who love performance, and hybrid can bring you both. And I think it's a decision that car makers will take. Toyota has made that decision. If you look at the ads for the Lexus, the ad doesn't say it's a hybrid. It says it's a V6 with the power of a V8. So this plus that equals that. And I think that is in the long run, this is how we're going to have to market hybrids to bring it to a broader audience. So let me do my summary here. HEV is here to stay. I think that the discussion is over. If you talk to the car manufacturers, they are all working on hybrids and bringing them out in future model years. You can also design it with performance. You're trading some fuel efficiency, but it'll still better than no hybrid. You're going to see significant increase in battery development, and as they make it into cars, that will translate into benefit in performance. Everybody's going lithium ion. Has the decision been made already? I think I said that. But I think maybe the last point to make is, you know, HEV is synergistic. We're not talking about HEV or diesel or better IC or fuel cells. HEV is essentially a power buffer. So whatever the power plant you're going to put in your car, whether it's better diesel or whatever, you will very likely want HEV for performance and for fuel efficiency. A major point, we have no major industry players in the U.S. today in lithium-ion batteries, although there are a few interesting startups. The last point I want to make is, what about PHEV? Because PHEV is essentially the technology that can change the landscape of liquid fuel consumption in transportation. So PHEV is plug-in HEV. That means you now have a big enough battery that you can also plug it in the wall, but it's still an HEV, so it's not an electric car. You can still, if your battery dies, you still have an engine. So it's essentially an electric car with the charger built in. This is the way you should think about it. And you can either run the charger or you can plug it in at night. I think the important thing about PHEV is that it's the first time we have arbitrage by the consumer. You know, the consumer can now either buy liquid fuel or they can buy electricity from the grid. When fuel prices go up, they can decide to get more electricity from the grid. And we're at the point where it looks damn enticing to get your power from the grid. So I think with that, I'll end, and thank you.
Frank, can I just note that Garrett made a very important point that everything you hear today will be physics.
The last session we had, everything we heard was going to be chemistry, so...
That's physics, too.
Nice. Dr. Sater, thank you. I'm not sure what you've done for new car sales anytime soon, but it was a terrific presentation. Dr. Xiao Horn is our next presenter, and please go ahead.
Good morning. So I want to tell you about fuel cells for transportation. So this schematic shows basically the basic concept for hybrid vehicles, particularly fuel cell hybrid vehicles. So we have fuel cells, batteries, power controller, and electric motor. So if you replace the fuel cells with the internal combustion engine, then you basically end up with Prius, basically our current hybrid vehicles. If you change the relative size of the batteries and your internal combustion engine, you can basically transform your Priuses to plug-in power hybrid vehicles. So what we can think from this basic concept, we can think of batteries and fuel cells as energy storage devices, and then really they enable us to make the vehicle more efficient. In addition, would allow us to use multiple fuels in the future. So the first message I want to convey is energy storage technology will be a critical component as we move away from our conventional fossil-based energy infrastructure to a clean, sustainable energy infrastructure. So if we look for clean, sustainable energy supply, we have few options. We have solar. Using solar electric conversion, we can convert solar energy to electric. We can also use solar energy and generate chemical energy, for example, hydrogen and ethanol as our fuel. We can generate electricity through nuclear or other renewable forms. With these clean energy options, we need energy storage technology to link energy supply and energy demand. For example, for transportation, we need to store the electricity generated with these clean energy technologies, with exception of solar fuel options. We generate electricity. And for transportation applications, we need to store electricity in a portable platform so we can drive or power the vehicle around. If we look at storage technologies, we can store energy in batteries, or we can store energy in hydrogen in a chemical form and get the energy out using fuel cells. There are two challenges associated with batteries and fuel cells for transportation. First is they have very low energy densities relative to the current fuel, gasoline, we are using. So this chart on the bottom left shows the energy density in terms of the vertical axis is energy density on the basis of volume, and the horizontal axis is energy density on the basis of weight. You can see gasoline is over here. It has very high energy density on the basis of volume and weight. If we look at the compressed hydrogen, it's down here. And it is an order of magnitude lower than that of gasoline. So in this chart, we have taken into consideration of the weight and volume of the container for the fuel. So as you can see, because we have a lower energy density, that really will really limit our driving range for transportation. And if you want to see where batteries, a lithium rechargeable battery, will fall on this chart, is even lower than compressed hydrogen. So that's one major challenge. If we want to develop a battery-powered or a hydrogen-powered vehicles, the driving range is a challenge. In addition, these systems also are very expensive, particularly on the basis of, in terms of, on the efficiency basis. The chart on the right shows basically the one fuel cell voltage as function of current density. So the right line corresponds to the actual fuel cell voltage. So the vertical axis, the current density, corresponds to power you can draw from, for example, from your fuel cell vehicle. The more power you draw from the vehicle, the voltage would decrease. And the efficiency of the system basically is equal to the ratio of your theoretical voltage, which is this blue line, relative to your measured voltage. So as you increase the power drawn from the vehicle, that your efficiency decreases. And there is a cost penalty for given efficiency, particularly for fuel cells. So let me tell you about how a fuel cell works. So our current fuel cell, we use hydrogen as the fuel and use oxygen in air as an oxidant. So on the left-hand side, we oxidize hydrogen and generate protons and electrons. And they travel, electrons will travel through the external circuit, and protons travel through an ion-conducting material. And they meet on the right-hand side, with combining with oxygen, they will form water. So for fuel cell to operate efficiently, we need to have a catalyst to help to promote the hydrogen oxidation and the oxygen reduction reactions. And just happened the best catalyst around for oxygen reduction and hydrogen oxidation is based on platinum, and they're very expensive. So there is a direct correlation between the efficiency of fuel cell versus how much platinum or the catalyst you put into the system. So once you put a structure like this, structure like this together, you form one single fuel cell. And based on 1 square centimeter, you can generate less than 1 watt. So if you want to build a system for a practical application, for example, for a vehicle, you will need 50 kilowatts. So you need to connect many of these single fuel cells together, particularly connecting them in series to develop a fuel cell stack to, for example, to provide 50 to 100 kilowatt of power required. So currently, the state-of-the-art fuel cell technology are reported from GM will provide you of you will need 0.5 grams of platinum per kilowatt. And the target cost will be 0.2 grams per kilowatt. And if you calculate the cost of this technology based on platinum alone, that even with the target value, you will end up with $300 per kilowatt. So that's still more expensive than the target value projected for advanced internal combustion engine technologies. So again, I want to point out that one has to evaluate the cost and power together in terms of a cost per kilowatt basis. In addition, not only they are expensive, the current catalyst, they don't last as long as we would like. So the fuel cell systems last only on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 hours. But we really would like to have these fuel cell vehicles to last for 5,000 hours for the lifetime of the vehicle. So there are many challenges associated with making fuel cells work. They have enormous opportunities, but there's many technical challenges at basic science level and also at the engineering level. There are two technical challenges I want to highlight in this presentation. One is oxygen reduction reaction, which is a key component in a fuel cell, and it is a four-electron reaction. So basically, you will take an oxygen molecule that you will inject electricity, and what we would like to do is to combine the oxygen molecule with four electrons and four protons to form two waters. And this is, again, a four-electron reduction process. It's extremely difficult, and we know at the fundamental level very little about this four-electron process. And this process occurs most efficiently on platinum-based catalyst. But we really like to understand the catalytic process better so that we can design and discover a catalyst that's not based on noble metals. So we can make, again, the cost efficiency numbers more promising. So that's for fuel cell and for energy generation. In addition, in order for fuel cell vehicles to really play an important role, we need to also care about hydrogen production and hydrogen storage on board. So associated with hydrogen production, you also have a 1-4 electron reduction, 4 electron oxidation, and this is basically is breaking up water molecules and generating hydrogen and oxygen. And again, in this process, one could either use solar or electricity and split water into oxygen molecules and hydrogen molecules. And again, this is almost like the reverse of the reaction for the oxygen reduction is, again, a 4 electron, and we know very little about the processes associated with the catalytic conversion. So we need discover new catalysts so with a lower cost and higher efficiency. And understanding catalytic process are key to enable us to not only finding efficient catalysts that are cost effective, but also discover a new catalytic processes and catalyst systems. So I here list a few research opportunities which I think could revolutionize our thinking of a catalyst. So, for example, understanding and manipulating molecular functions would allow one to design smaller molecules for hydrogen generation and oxygen reduction. And Professor Daniel Sir at MIT has generated and produced a series of small molecules has shown great promise for such a purpose. In addition, with the recent advances in nanotechnologies, we can manipulate materials, the surfaces, the size, and the shape, and the chemistry much better from the nanometer to the from the atomic nanometer and micrometer scale, which allow us to develop model systems to discover new catalytic processes and also design a better catalyst. So with that, well, I would like to end with the message. I think fuel cell vehicles are promising, offers a great promise, not only for transportation, but also as a way to store energy for stationary power systems. However, there are tremendous research and development are required in the near term and also in the long term.
Thank you. These are excellent presentations. Let me ask you a quick question. Staying on batteries and fuel cells, you talked about lifespan. What is recyclable in terms of catalysts or batteries or fuel cells, and is there a disposal problem?
So in theory, we would like to recycle all the platinum used in the fuel cell, and it can be recycled perhaps in a similar fashion as the platinum used in the catalytic converter.
Okay. Seems like we're back to chemistry as well as physics.
That's applied physics.
Ah, there we go.
Jeez.
We're going to open the floor to questions now. We have two simple rules here. We have microphones that we'll have, and they're available on the sides. If you'll identify yourself and if you'll pose the question in the form of a question, that would be extremely helpful. So please go ahead. We'll start on that side.
I'd like to pose the looking at the whole view of transportation a little differently. There are people who have given us some really novel ways of looking at the automobile. The purpose of the automobile, presumably most of the time, is to transfer a couple of 100 kilograms of human from place A to place B. And the way we do it now is essentially refining a system of gasoline engines and gasoline engines and so forth. If our game plan is to go from point A to point B without losing that 80% of efficiency along the way, could we design a car It just has a couple of wheels being driven by electrical motors with fuel cells or whatever as the driving systems, using perhaps new systems of catalysts or whatever, and really redesign the car completely, not just refine what's there.
Thanks. Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm Martin Apple from the Council of Scientific Society Presidents.
Thank you.
Let me suggest one area that we are not talking about nearly enough, and that is what's the right vehicle concept or set of vehicle concepts and vehicle size. We've had many decades where vehicles are general-purpose vehicles, several passengers, baggage, 4x8 plywood sheets, all sorts of stuff. They're general-purpose vehicles. Maybe we will need to transition to a variety of special-purpose vehicles. I've been using a concept car Volkswagen has, which does 100 kilometers on 1 liter. And a newsman asked me, well, is it possible to get 200 miles per gallon? And I almost said no, and then I quickly did the mental arithmetic. One liter per 100 kilometers is 234 miles per gallon. Close enough. And you say, really? What does it look like? Well, it's a two-seater, passenger behind the driver. Looks like a car. It's small. It's light. Standard technology, but a very different form of car. Right now, we as individuals, the car industry, our governments, we're saying we're not brave enough at present to change the concept of the car. Well, my message, I think, is, and you've asked the question, we will have to. So let's get started looking at some alternatives and find out how promising they could be.
Which will make battery-powered and fuel cell-powered vehicles more competitive?
It's Joe in back.
Joe Masita from Gibbs Energy, and I actually have a question for each of the panelists. For Dr. Haywood, I'm curious about the 0.5% per year growth, because Toyota's been observing almost 4% per year growth in mileage on individual cars as they've done the tally on their maintenance and warranty. And they're saying that they're basically getting double the growth that they're getting that offsets their efficiency gain. So that's one question. And then I'd also like to ask regarding fuel cells, have you looked at more at what both the Japanese and Russians did? Because the Toyota fuel cell has hit 8,000 hours, and they've gone away from Nafion-based membranes, which are probably going to at some point not be available here in this country because they developed the new Asahi glass. And they have a very flat VI curve. They've really it seems that they've overcome that. And have you been investigating other electrolytes as well as other catalyst structures?
Let me start with your question about growth rates. I think I said 1%. And it depends which parameter, but we've looked at the last 25 years in the U.S., and you do a sales-weighted average of all the engines that are sold over that 25 years, and it works out to be, actually it's 1.5%, but to avoid seeming too optimistic, I drop it a bit. So that's an average. So obviously some companies will be above, some companies may not make it, and it depends how you work the average out. So I don't think there's not much disagreement, and the technology improves really through almost all of the big companies in parallel ways.
Okay.
You want to pick up the fuel cell?
Yeah. So absolutely. So there are numbers have been reported, for example, greater than 2,000 hours. So it really depends on how you operate the fuel cell. So the durability of fuel cell is dependent on how you operate. So fuel cell like to be operated under steady state. So that means that if you want to operate the fuel cell under steady state, then you need to have relatively large battery systems to be able to take up the peak loads. So it's really a matter of the size of battery versus size of fuel cell. And the fuel cells, they don't last as long if you have to, for example, force a fuel cell to operate transient. So it's a matter, I think, is really from a system or engineering design point of view. So that's one point. So the numbers of the hours of operation depends on how you operate fuel cell. Second, absolutely, so the membrane plays an important role. So as far as I understood that the Nafion or modified Nafion membranes is still the most chemically stable membrane available relative to other alternative membrane systems. Sure. So it depends on what, again, operating conditions you choose. So, for example, a Nafion membrane cannot be used above 100 degrees C. So if you want to operate, for example, a 120 or 150, which to improve, again, the lifetime of the vehicle and also the efficiency of the vehicle, then you need to find alternative membrane systems.
Adam Siegel, Northrop Grumman Analysis Center, also a board member of the Energy Consensus, which does the lecture series here in town. A couple questions. Professor Haywood, on terms of life cycle cost and such in terms of the analysis, when people say that plug-in, when the hybrid vehicles are not cost-effective right now, in general, I feel that they're not doing a total systems analysis. For example, there's a cost-benefit of not having to go to the gas station 30% fewer times. There's a time value to that. There's an economic value for people of having quieter cars. There are, if one defines economic value simply gasoline against the cost of the hybrid, it may be a different question if you do a fuller value of time value of people's time value or what people are willing to pay for in terms of I can have a higher performance car, I'm willing to pay for that, or I can have a quieter car, I'm willing to pay for that. There are other more extensive total operating costs or total life cycle cost analysis that really, I believe, changed the question. And also to Professor Sedar, and excuse me for the pronunciation, my German is very bad, but in terms of looking at the hybrids and where they're going and the different levels of hybrids, I'm hearing things like the Toyota in theory in the 2008 year, the Prius is going to be, what is it, I'm hearing between 90 and 110 miles per gallon is at least some of the rumint on places like Green Car Congress and otherwise is going around of a very extensive leap in some of the hybrid technologies in the next couple of years. And I appreciate comments on that.
Thanks. Dr. Hammond?
My statement about hybrid costs not being justified at present was based on sort of normal consumer economics with a short time frame, 5 years, you want to recover the extra that you've invested. But let me add to that by saying, if I sounded pessimistic on hybrids, I did not intend to. I just wanted to sort of get the realities out there in front of us. Because the hybrid concept, building electrical energy storage, or maybe there's some equivalence to that, but let's stay with electrical energy storage, into the vehicle, provides, if you like, new sources of energy on the vehicle. It makes it easier to switch the engine off at idle. You can do that with very simple hybrids that don't cost very much, by the way. But the regenerative braking, that takes more technology, and that's a new source of energy. So as a concept, it's technically very attractive, and so the challenge is, can we bring the costs down so that the sort of immediate market appeal goes up and the growth curves in sales get better. I will just add, all technologies, gasoline engines, diesel engines, hybrids, plug-in hybrids, fuel cells, they all get worse as we emphasize better performance at the expense of better fuel consumption. Be very wary of the word efficiency. A really big sport utility vehicle is about as efficient as a small car, but its fuel consumption is 3 times. So think fuel consumption. It's fuel that we consume that matters and contributes greenhouse gases. You're next. Good.
I think you're absolutely right about doing a total systems analysis, and I would include in there consumer happiness and satisfaction. If you went 10 years ago to the car companies and you asked them, what is an extra mile per gallon worth of fuel efficiency, the number they would come back to is very close to zero. Because they would pull and they would ask in consumer groups, how much are you willing to pay to go from 30 to 31 miles per gallon? And if you ask a consumer like that, the answer is they don't really want to pay for it. what Toyota did brilliantly was that they put a nameplate on the car. The car now said hybrid, and that meant you could feel good about yourself. If you were asked to spend $2,000 more to get that extra mileage, you probably wouldn't have bought it. But it now was a label on the car, and you could label yourself environmentally conscious. And, you know, this is very important. The early adopters did not buy this car just because it was going to save them money. They bought this car because it was the right thing to do. And I think, you know, we all buy things that don't improve our efficiency. We buy leather seats in our car. We buy a moonroof. We buy them because we like them and they make us feel good. And I think a lot of these cost calculations are completely ridiculous because people buy all the time things that improve their fuel efficiency. Now, to come back to the 90 or 100 miles per gallon comment, you know, I think this is something John already said. Is it possible to engineer such a car and get that mileage under certain circumstances? I think the answer is absolutely. There are people who hold web contests, like I got 100 miles per gallon, and that's out of a normal Prius, by the way, the current one. Yeah, if all you do is like, you know, 20, 30 miles per hour and you just slowly accelerate, slowly decelerate, all you're essentially doing is regenerative braking, pumping it back, regenerative braking. You can now reach 100 miles an hour. If they can significantly improve the electric motor technology, which they are already doing, and the battery technology, they will go up considerably. I had not heard 100 miles per hour, which seems a bold statement.
Per gallon,
yeah, sorry, 100 miles per gallon. 100 miles per hour would be fine, too.
Ooh, that's a hybrid or a plug-in?
The claim is hybrid and not plug-in.
Toyota to participate later on in the year, and we do automotive technologies.
Sure. Mitch had a comment. Along the lines of that Gehr mentioned this issue of with hybrids and the introduction through a market, people who want it to be environmentally friendly, et cetera. But I think it raises a broader point that I think should not be missed in this discussion broadly about energy technology innovation and introductions. Often we think of the innovation in certain technology areas, you know, going through this kind of classic, you know, disruptive track where you start out with a bunch of niche markets, et cetera. But a caution is to remember that often those niche markets are when you provide a genuinely new functionality or service, a cell phone, mobility, for example, et cetera. In the energy technology business, generally speaking, you are not providing a new functionality. A wonderful biofuel still just moves your car the way gasoline does. A wonderful photovoltaic provides electricity the same way a coal plant does. And so one of the challenges always in the energy technology introduction business is that it's much more price sensitive than breakthrough technologies in other areas. And that's something that I think John raised in effect and we need to keep in mind.
Let me give some response to that. In the fleet modeling that we're doing, that I briefly described an example, we are attempting to predict rates of penetration. You could say it's sort of informed guesswork, I'll be honest. But at least we can vary it and understand how rapidly does the fleet gasoline demand, greenhouse gas emissions change as a result of making these assumptions. And we talked to a lot of people about what's plausible in terms of rate of growth of hybrids, rate of growth of diesels in the U.S. market, these kind of questions. The answer is the lead times are very long, and we can roughly estimate them. Some of the technology is not ready. It's got to be developed. And then you've got to build up production. And does market demand exist? Do we have the facilities? There's lots of reasons why that is constrained. And then the stuff's got to get out there and be driven around to have an impact. All of that takes much longer than we think. That feeds back into what should we do about it. We should recognize that making changes takes a long time because the system is so large and there are long turnover times, multi-years. And we should recognize that, you know, we'd better get a move on and look at our options, not one at a time. Oh, it'll be wonderful if biofuels take over and we don't have to worry about this. Such a naive statement. And yet biofuels can provide a very important cushion in the tightness that is now there between petroleum demand and petroleum supply. So I think we've got to look at our options realistically. But then we got to say to ourselves, we need to get going on this. And there was, in fact, an editorial in the Washington Post this morning that I read before I came here, which underlines that.
From a policy perspective, though, if you really believe that there's technological change, you know, just around the corner, depending how long the block is, does that deter people from making new investments at this stage? If you think a better hybrid is going to be available in 2008, it's a step change from what you have now. Do you really lose the benefit of, you know, the incremental change in the short term? And how big a problem is that?
Well, just quickly, I think you have to incentivize at the consumer level and at the company level getting from the transportation technology path we're on, which is we make the technology steadily better, but we largely put it into performance, larger vehicles, heavier vehicles. You have to change that dynamic, and that takes push and pull with regulatory and fiscal measures, and that's a big topic. But we've got to take that seriously and decide what do we want to accomplish and look into the best ways of doing it.
Could I just add on that the of course, the classic policy response is to have the government, let's say, to recognize what are the public goods and then to internalize them either through a regulation or through costs. Clearly, we have not shown the will, only the will to complain as opposed to the will to actually put in place a policy that would value either our security goals or our environmental goals. And to indicate how, frankly, in my view, pitiful the situation is, let's talk about climate change, which, of course, goes to carbon, and carbon goes to any of the fossil fuels. We hear enormous discussions and wringing of hands about the possibility that, let's say, carbon dioxide emissions would be priced at, $50 a ton of carbon dioxide. This is just off scale. The Europe is now at around $20, something like that. And $50 is getting into a region where you can imagine you start to influence the problem. Well, that corresponds to a whole 50 cents a gallon of gasoline. And that's what we are wringing our hands about and doing nothing about. So the fact is, until we in fact, Susan Hockfield basically said this morning, these technologies, these kinds of technologies, kinds we'll hear in the afternoon and others, really are essential for addressing the problems we're talking about, the problems that Tony raised, et cetera. But the fact is, without an aligned set of policies that reflect the public goods, we don't get there in time. And let's face it, in our initiative at MIT, that's why we are from the beginning insisting that we integrate these social, political, economic, and policy considerations, and hopefully we can help as best we can, at least, to influence that synergy that's required between technology and policy.
Well, just a small comment. I think one thing that a lot of efficient technologies or clean technologies have in common is that they require more capital outlay up front, either from a government or from a consumer. And even if they do pay back, I mean, I think there's sort of a historic record here that even if they do pay back themselves in 5 years or so, consumers don't buy them. That is one of the issues that Susan Hockfield brought up this morning. That's the big problem in the construction sector. We could save enormous amounts of energy there, but, you know, you're already scraping down your checkbook to pay that down payment. You don't want to put out another 50,000. And I think we're seeing the same thing. Even if hybrid get to the point where over the life cycle of the vehicle it's more fuel efficient and saves you money, it will probably still cost more to actually buy it.
Imagine that. One more comment, Frank, because along Gerd reminds me. I mean, we should recognize that there are interesting policy things going on, not at the federal level, but in the states. We are seeing some very interesting activities, and one that's not in the transportation sector, but you're reminded with buildings, is in California and with the governor. Now it's a very interesting electricity pricing structure on residences with tiers, with very different rates as you get up into, you know, the 30,000 square foot home range. So there are very, very interesting policy experiments going on in regions and cities and states, but we've got to translate them to the national and ultimately international level to have any real impact.
Thanks, Ernie. We have time for one more question, and then we'll have to move on. So go ahead.
Hi, I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant. For the fuel cells, what will get down the cost for the first cost, and what will extend the life best? Is it looking at the catalysts? Is it looking at manufacturing techniques, or what?
So at this time, nearly 80% of the cost for fuel cells, so if you look at the fuel cell stack, really come from materials used in fuel cells, meaning catalyst and the membrane. So, for example, developing non-noble metal-based catalyst can definitely decrease the cost of fuel cell systems, or developing perhaps alternative membrane technology can also bring down the cost. In terms of durability, so catalysts degrade over time. So I think that's, again, also depends on under what condition you want to operate your fuel cells. The stability of the catalyst and the membranes are the key limiting factors at this time.
I'd like you to join me in thanking our panel. We're going to change out, bring up the second panel, and then we're going to continue right again. Thank you so much. Thanks, John.
Let's see. I think we'll go ahead and get started. For those of you in the back, just gathering beverages, if you'd quiet your conversations, that'd be appreciated. Thank you. I'm Douglas Arendt. I'm the Director of Strategic Analysis at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and also a visiting fellow here at CSIS. And it's a pleasure to start the second panel. Do want to provide one linkage remark, which is related back to the chart that Ernie put up this morning, which is the two principal areas where we can really have impact if we're thinking about carbon. The first was transportation. The second one was electricity. The other key linkage to think about, of course, and we touched upon it a little bit this morning, is plug-in electric vehicles. It's the opportunity to provide the consumer plus corporations arbitrage among their energy sources. And I think the repeat President Hockfield's remark, it's a multi-pronged strategy, multi-pathway solutions, and that's just one more piece of the puzzle, which is to arbitrage between electricity and liquid fuels for transportation. So with that, we're going to turn toward alternative advanced electricity technologies, and we've got a panel of experts here to talk about that. To start us off is Howard Herzog, and he's going to talk about coal and carbon sequestration. Of course, you've got his bio. I encourage you to read it in detail. He comes with a great pedigree, and we look forward to his remarks. If you'd start, please.
Okay. That better? Once again, sorry. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you about coal and carbon dioxide capture and sequestration. So I guess time's short, so I'll get right into the talk here. Let me frame the issue. As we all know, coal is a very important energy source. It's relatively cheap and abundant. I just came from an IPCA meeting, and yesterday we had a talk from someone from the IEA and talked about their 2006 outlook. And in there, they show over the next 25 years or so, coal actually increasing its market share in the world, the world's energy economy. And, of course, we all know about China and India and their large resources of coal and their very fast-growing economies and growing energy use. It's cheap, it's abundant, it's dirty compared to, say, natural gas, but the criteria pollutants of sulfur oxides, nitrogen oxides, particulates, and mercury, they all can be controlled at reasonable costs. People have pronounced coal dead many times in the past, and those plants are still kicking. Some of these plants have been going on for 50 and 60 years, and they're chugging away and are some of the most profitable plants we have in our electricity system. There is a big threat, of course, a serious concern, and that's CO2 emissions, and these climate concerns are a real serious threat to the future use of coal if we really are going to limit the amount of CO2 emissions we have in the future. There is one technology, and that'll be the focus of this talk, that can sort of still allow us to use our coal resources, yet not emit that CO2 to the atmosphere, and that's called CO2 capture and storage. It's a technology. I'll go into the background in a few minutes, but it's a technology not that many people have heard about. We did some polling studies, public service polling, 3 years ago, and one of the things we wanted to do on that poll was see how many people have heard of CO2 capture and storage, and back then 5% of the general U.S. public had heard about it. We've actually just rerun the poll this last month, and just 2 days ago I got the preliminary data, so we took a quick look, and that number has really remained unchanged in the last 3 years. Al Gore did mention CO2 capture and storage in his movie, so that's a little thing, but the amount of people that saw his movies probably less than 5% of the general public also, so that doesn't help us in name recognition. But so I'll explain what we mean by it and some of the roles that we played. MIT has been a pioneer in this field. We did our first research project in 1989, where at that time I could actually lead just about all the literature on the subject that was out there, and it didn't take me that long because there wasn't that much published. We've been working closely with DOE over the years, and in 93 we did the first comprehensive research needs assessment in this area, and there's an international meeting that's held every 2 years. It started in 92. It was called the International Conference on Carbon Dioxide Removal. Since been renamed Greenhouse Gas Control Technology Conference, or GHGT. But at MIT, we hosted the third one. And if you flip down to the bottom of the slides there, we are going to be organizing the ninth one here in Washington, D.C. in 2008 over at the Omni Shoreham Hotel with funding from DOE and other sponsors to be recruited. Number eight was just held in Trondheim, Norway, not an easy place to get to, but we had 1,000 people there. So interest in the subject is great. DOE actually launched the program in the late 90s as a budget item, and we worked with them. We wrote a white paper. We held some stakeholders meetings for them, and the program now has about $70 million a year being spent on CO2 capture and sequestration. At MIT, part of our work is funded through an initiative, an industrial consortium called the Carbon Sequestration Initiative, and we're up to about 15 companies, include some of the big auto companies, some of the big oil companies, coal companies, supplier companies. So it's a broad industrial participation as opposed to a single industry, and I think that's very important as we move forward. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change recognized that it was an important area and issued a special report in September 2005, of which I participated in as one of the coordinating lead authors, and that's available on the web. Next slide, I think, has the website that you can go to and look at that. And also, we participate in the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum, which is a government-to-government body that tries to foster international collaboration in this area. And also, I'll mention that a big part of the Cole study, and I wasn't here for the morning session, but I assume Ernie must have mentioned the Cole. No, you didn't. We're doing a major Cole study, which is sort of a follow-up to the nuclear study we did at MIT, and carbon sequestration and plays a major part of that study. Well, let me get right to, you know, some questions that people always ask, and maybe the first question to ask is, what is carbon dioxide capture and storage? And I just quoted right here, right from the IPCC special report, but you see what we're looking at is capture of CO2 from large concentrated sources. The biggest target of these will be power plants, but there's other industrial sources that can also be happening, refineries, ammonia plants, natural gas processing. And some of those industrial sources have some attributes that maybe is where we're going to start, because it may be easier to capture the CO2 from there. Then we're going to transport it to a secure location and isolate it long-term from the atmosphere. You know, so the first question is, can you really do it? And every component in this chain is being done today. There's power plants where you capture at least part of the CO2. That CO2 is being used for commercial markets, but the technology is there to do that. Secondly, we have about 2,000 miles of CO2 pipelines in this country. And thirdly, we inject maybe 40 million tons of CO2 into the ground each year, a lot of it for enhanced oil recovery, but also we do that with acid gas operations. It's also fairly similar to injecting natural gas into the ground for natural gas storage for seasonal peaking. All of these things are here, but the scale that we're going to need to do it at, also maybe the cost, aren't quite where we want it. But at least from a technical feasibility situation, we know we can do it, but we still have work ahead of us to do it on a large scale and make what we call in the Cole study, make an impact at the gigaton scale, basically a gigaton of carbon a year. And that's a big jump from where we are today. Why is CCS limited today? And the answer is very simple. There is no reason to put CO2 in the ground, to spend all the money to capture it, transport it, put it in the ground, unless there's some policy that's going to drive this. So with lack of carbon policy, we're not going to do it. Now, if you look at some of the other mitigation options, such as more renewable energy or energy conservation, there are other reasons to do that besides carbon, but carbon also gets a benefit. But here, there is no reason to do maybe on the broad level called carbon management unless you have a carbon policy that drives it. Despite the carbon policy, there are three carbon sequestration facilities in the world today. These are not from power plants. These are from oil and gas operations. These are at about 1 million tons of CO2 a year being put into the ground. One Sleipner in the North Sea, operating since 1996 by Statoil. They have to capture the gas anyways to make it pipeline quality. They have to capture the CO2 from their gas to make it pipeline quality, and they, instead of venting it to the atmosphere, which is the usual thing, they're injecting it into a saline aquifer about a kilometer below the North Sea. Insala is a BP project in the Algerian desert, and once again, it's a byproduct of natural gas, and they're putting it in there. Why are they doing these things? Well, in Sleipner, there was a carbon tax. I think BP is doing it. There's no carbon tax in Algeria, but BP did have a strong commitment to reducing CO2 emissions within their company. So they are doing this, and these are, I would say, some of the less expensive forms of carbon sequestration, but we do see it even with lack of general policy. In general, the type of pathways one may see for doing CO2 capture and storage are three. The three examples I gave here are from the far left, going through industrial processes. These are processes today that basically produce a fairly pure CO2 stream coming out. So you don't have to capture it. You basically have to just compress it and put it in the ground. That is a lot less money than the middle path, which is getting from power plants where you have the CO2 coming out. If it's a coal plant, maybe at 15% concentration, down to 5% or even less in a gas plant. And these are atmospheric streams, so it's much harder and more expensive to capture the CO2. That's where the cost of these that's where the real cost of this thing is going to be. However, it's the power plants that the CO2 is coming out, so we need to do that. There have been, I would say, maybe about 10 power projects with carbon capture and storage announced from around the world, a lot of them from Europe, where they have the European trading system, and all their utilities are under that, with carbon prices pushing $20 a ton CO2. There has been a couple in the United States. The most famous one is FutureGen, which is a basically a cost share with the government putting up about 80% of the funds to do this. It'd be about 275 megawatt power plant. Right now, they whittled down the sites to either Illinois or Texas, and they would put at least 1 million tons a year of CO2 in the ground as part of this. They aren't at the phase where they have shovels in the ground. There's still some procurement money to go, and whether it goes ahead or not won't be known for another year or two. BP has also announced a project in the U.S., the Carson Project down in California, where they would use petroleum coke to make about 500 megawatts of electricity, also maybe a little hydrogen. There's a lot of petroleum coke in the refineries out there. They would use the CO2 for enhanced oil recovery in California, where there's a need, especially in the Bakersfield area, and sell the electricity into a market that is desperate for electricity out there. So whether that goes ahead, once again, is to be seen, but that those projects have been announced. The last column there is important because there has been talk of things like coal making CO2 from diesel from coal and conversion, and if you do that, you start having very carbon intensive gasoline or diesel or automotive fuels. If you do carbon sequestration with that, you can get it neutral. Now, if you can actually get to hydrogen as an energy carry into there, you can basically remove most of the carbon, just like you do in the electricity. And the additional cost of making, of capturing the CO2 in a hydrogen production is more like on the industrial process. It's very small compared to the much more expensive power production process. So that... So that's a possible future operations if we go that way. Well, I mentioned cost, and the cost that you're really going to look at here is about $30 a ton of CO2 before you really start seeing, I think, major projects come out and start taking market share. And this is about $100 a ton of carbon. Numbers vary, but rule of thumb is 80% of this cost is going to be at the power plant associated with capture and compression. You need to get the CO2 into a dense phase, basically almost like a liquid CO2 to put into the pipe and inject into the ground. And then the 20% is associated with transport and injection. How far you can transport depends, but give you an idea, transport at a large scale could be less than $1 per ton per 100 miles. So, you know, if you're within a couple hundred miles, it could only be $2 or $3 for the transport if you have a good enough scale. The scale I'm talking about is maybe 10 million tons a year. There are targets of opportunity. We talked about the industrial byproduct pathway. You can get some money back if you can use CO2 for commercial markets. Right now, the only real big market for it is EOR, and that's like tens of millions of tons a year there. People are trying to look at near-term opportunities. The G8 challenged the IEA and the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum to come up with a plan. They did this in 2005, and So a workshop was held last month in San Francisco, but how these government things work, they're going to have a report back to the G8 in 2008. So I don't know what they mean by near term, but it's 3 years just to do the report. So you can see it takes a while to get these things going. Anyways, as we move forward, and I see I'm nearing the end of my time, so what we see as the key challenges for moving forward with carbon capture and storage is, one, reducing costs, and this is primarily associated with capture, and second, reducing the uncertainty associated with geologic storage at scale. And this is both the scientific and the regulatory uncertainty. And I don't have time to go into our coal study, but one of the major recommendations are going to be coming out of the coal study is we need to do demonstrations at scale. We need more than one, maybe 5 to 10, maybe 3 or 4 focused on the underground and several others focused on the capture. If we can combine them together, that'd be really nice, but that won't be necessary. But we really need to do this at scale. We know we can do this, in niche markets and small things, but if we're going to succeed and this make a dent and also to keep coal as an option in the future in a carbon-constrained world, we're going to need to do this at scale, and the sooner the better. Thank you.
Thank you. Clearly a great amount of opportunity as well as challenge there, and particularly when we think broadly across the world and the increasing amount of electricity generation going in, particularly in China, where they're building a new coal plant about every 3 weeks. We're turning now to Professor Kazemi, did I get that correct, who's an expert in nuclear power and is going to talk to us about next-generation nuclear technologies.
I guess I'm going to move the discussion into a certain part of the world of physics where energy is not conserved. We derive nuclear energy from mass, so we don't conserve energy in that sense. But rather than discussing the fundamentals, we're going to have we're going to have to look at the technology which is derived with that approach. And we are near 50 years after the first reactor was established. And today we have about 103 reactors operating in the United States, providing about 20% of our electricity. So we've had a lot of experience, and experience has been getting better and better with time. If you look at the graph that is shown there, I guess I have a pointer here, the graph shows that, in fact, nuclear power growth in the last 15 years has been at the same pace as the growth of natural gas-derived power. And that has come mostly because we are improving the operation of the existing plants, not because we're building so many plants. As a matter of fact, the last plant that was finished in the mid-90s, so we haven't had a new plant as such for at least 10 years. However, we've added also power to the existing plants, almost to the extent of about 3 new reactors over the last decade by increasing in a little bit at a time the power in about 50 such reactors. So with that, the contribution of nuclear energy has been increasing, not only in the United States but also worldwide, where about 16% of the electricity is derived today. And lately, because of the price of the other natural sources of energy, as well as worries about the security of their supplies, there is much more discussion about what to do in the future. The utilities have also grasped the need for diversification and indicated to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission they are thinking about 30 new reactors in the United States over the next decade or so. This is, of course, somewhat influenced by the fact that the government in the Energy Act of 2005 has put certain incentives for the utilities, particularly the first movers, in order to try to get the nuclear energy back into the market. Economics is one of the challenges of nuclear energy. The nuclear plants cost a lot, and if you look, in fact, at the graph, all these blue bars indicate that a nuclear plant probably is slightly more expensive than a coal plant on per kilowatt electric basis, significantly more than a gas plant or a wind plant would cost on a kilowatt electric basis. But, of course, you can run a nuclear power all the time. In fact, the average capacity factor these days for nuclear plants is approximately 90%. It used to be only about 65% in 1980. That's why we have much more nuclear energy today than we used to have. And gas, because it became very expensive, is not running as a preferred electricity source today. It might, if the energy, if the cost of the natural gas comes down again, go back to a capacity factor that is also comparable. That would be a challenge, but nobody expects the gas to be as cheap in the future as it has been in the past. Wind is a different situation. Although it's very inexpensive as a plant to build, it's not available continuously. And the best wind farm that we have today probably gives about 30% in terms of capacity factor. So when you consider the actual cost of the plant on a the production factoring in this kind of capacity factor, you see that nuclear is reasonable to proceed forward in the future. Besides that, the industry has tried to improve the technology by looking in the reactors that the utilities are going to implement at simplified plants, removing a number of loops, for example, for the Westinghouse plant from 4 to 2. That immediately reduces the number of pumps and valves and so forth associated with the plant. Standardization so that you can build with one design, let's say 10 or so plants that will bring down the cost. And going to larger size from a typical 1,000 to typically 1,500 megawatt plant, all of this would give us in the future economic benefit. Now let me turn and talk about a few of the MIT ideas that might help also in driving the cost down in the future. And perhaps like what John Haywood mentioned with regards to the existing engines in the cars, you know, we haven't given up on the light water reactor technology, which is the basis of what we do today. We think there is plenty of room for improving that technology. And in particular, if one is able to increase the power density in the core, one can drive the cost down, because that means for the same vessel, for the same containment, you can bring 50% or so more power. So we're looking at redesigning the nuclear fuel such that it would allow the production of more power per unit volume in the core. One of such ideas is to go from a cylinder that is cooled only on the outside to a cylinder that's cooled on the inside as well as the outside. This annular fuel is a project that we teamed with Westinghouse and a couple of other smaller industrial group on to develop, and it looks very promising. To the extent that we think we can increase the power by approximately 50% for pressurized water reactor. Today we are being supported by some industrial firms to look at boiling water reactors where the fuel may not necessarily look the same. Notice that one of the interesting things is that while the power will be up, the temperature at which this annular fuel is going to operate is way down compared to the temperature that the current fuel operates at. Because of the availability of more surface to extract the energy from, and because of the smaller resistance in such a geometry to conduction than in such a geometry, you find that the temperature is better. And once the fuel temperature is down, you get safety benefits. And when you want to cool down quickly, you get a neutronic benefit, because now you don't have the so-called Doppler effect between the cold and the operating temperatures. And finally, you also get operating benefit, because you retain more of the fission gases produced during irradiation within the matrix. You don't release them outside the matrix itself. So there are many benefits for this approach that we are trying to explore. Another approach for increasing the power density is changing the properties of water using a nano approach, if you wish, by adding a small volume, maybe 0.001% or even 0.01% to the coolant of something, very tiny particles on the nanoscale. The limiting heat flux that's supplied from the fuel to the coolant can be increased maybe up to 80%. And we found that in pool boiling experiments that are being run and have run already in the lab, and we are working on flow boiling experiments today to see if the same properties would be achieved. And one doesn't have to introduce exotic materials. One can introduce zirconium oxide as a nanoparticle. Zirconium oxide happens to be the corrosion product of the cladding in current PWRs and BWRs. So this is a material that already exists in the plant. Now, in a future, maybe let's say midterm option for nuclear power, perhaps one can move from the water-cooled technology to the gas-cooled technology. The gas-cooled technology has been looked at in the past, both in the United States and in Germany. We've built reactors that had gas-cooled reactors, but we coupled them to a steam turbine, and the performance of the two together was not as impressive as we would like it to be. Today, on the drawing boards in a couple of countries, particularly South Africa and China, there are plans in which they are coupling the gas-cooled reactor with a gas turbine, and since the gas turbine technology has improved quite a bit over the last 25 years, this is going to boost the potential efficiency of the conversion from the light water reactor today of about 33% to about 45% in such future reactors. They have also several other advantages, like safety, for example. You don't care about loss of coolant as much in such reactors because they can cool themselves through conduction in the graphite and so forth. And our own approach is to look at the fuel made out of pebble particles, which is a technology that the Germans had developed, not the ones that the U.S. has built in Colorado in the past. And the government has a plan to demonstrate this new technology at Idaho by putting together the nuclear plant with two hydrogen-producing plants. And the whole idea is that the reactor will run at sufficiently high temperature that, in fact, you can experiment with a high-temperature electrolysis unit as well as a thermochemical approach to production of hydrogen. This way, perhaps in the future, we can produce hydrogen needed using these reactors. We can produce hydrogen today through electrolysis from the existing reactors, but that will have lower efficiency. Now, you might say, why do we need nuclear hydrogen? Well, we've already heard that story today. Earlier in the sessions, I've talked about, you know, looking at new approaches, perhaps in the long term, looking at fuel cells for car. But in the short term, we need a lot of hydrogen just to sweeten the heavy oils. We need a lot of hydrogen if we want to do ammonia. And all of that's being produced today using natural gas, which means CO2 emissions and means also higher prices. So by switching to electrolysis through nuclear power, we can get away from that. In the very long term, I'd like to use some of the CO2 captured by HAWI into a way to combine it with hydrogen produced by nuclear plants to produce the synthetic fuels like ethanol or even gasoline. This will have some carbon reduction for sure, but it might be more costly than we can afford today. We are working on a way to reduce that cost, again, by looking at technology that will use supercritical CO2 in the powertrain rather than helium, which is a traditional design that has advantages in terms of being able to derive a lot of energy at low temperature in the plant, but also size-wise. If you look at the size of a steam turbine and the equivalent size of a helium turbine, compare that to the size of a CO2 turbine, and you can immediately tell that there are tremendous advantages in the cost of the plant based on that technology. So this is an approach that we are studying with some help from the Navy as well as from the DOE. Finally, with the last minute that I might have, let me say something about management of spent fuel. It is felt that the spent fuel from nuclear power is a difficult problem. It is a difficult problem because it has radioactivity that can live for a long, long time. But in terms of volume, it's actually a relatively small volume. All the 100 plants per year produce about 2,000 tons of uranium, which is approximately 600 cubic meter. That's less than what will fit in this room from the 100 plants per year. So if you are able to then project what we need in terms of volume in the future, even with 100 plants operating for 60 years, it's going to be manageable. Where the problem is how to do it without having radiation seep into the environment for a long, long time. One has to be careful about what approach to use. We are currently using a once-through, but we are discussing the potential for implementing a recycling scheme. Recycling today is practiced in France, will be practiced in Japan, is talked about also in Russia and a few other places. And with recycling, a question is, do you need to go with all the fuel, with all the plutonium in one reactor, or do you take the plutonium away from the minor actinides and use two reactors? There are differences in the characteristics which make fast reactors potentially appropriate for the minor actinides. What we are trying to do here is to show that one can use existing reactors, namely light water reactors, in order to do quite a bit of actinide burning, because you can exchange one row of the fuel elements in the assembly, and that will give you about 20% of the fuel made of non-uranium elements that contain the plutonium. It would enable you to reduce, to some extent, the amount of radioactivity that will end up going into the repository or into the second burner, like a fast reactor. Once you do enough recycling, you reduce the longevity of the radioactivity that you you have to worry about it from about 1 million years to approximately 1,000 years. And the 1,000 years guarantee that the fission products that we generate, which are about 5% of the spent fuel, would be all decayed after that time. So in order to help make choices among the various options of technology that we have developed a code to look at the system of the nuclear fuel cycle, and we've used it. We are at the beginning of stages to use it to see what is the impact of sizing the recycling plants, either small or large, and implementing a thermal recycling steam versus different types of fast reactors in the future. And unfortunately, because of the time limitation, we'll not be able to discuss them today. But the message I want to say is that nuclear power has a lot of options for future applications. And, you know, we see the potential for reducing the cost as well as the difficulty in waste handling in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. I think I'll repeat that key message at the end that I heard, is that nuclear opens up a lot of opportunities for supporting alternative fuel pathways, and again, along the comments, and I think the theme of the day of multi-stranded approaches, it's something we should keep in mind. We're now going to turn the podium over to Dr. Belovich, who's an expert in solar energy and a professor, associate professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. So, please.
Thank you. So the message I'll try to give you today is very, very simple. We have an abundant source of energy that we are simply not utilizing to the best of our ability. We want to identify that new source, and my claim would be that solar, indeed, is the place to look at for a very simple reason. If you look at the 1 year of fossil energy production use and actually plot it as a box, and then compare that to the 1 year of solar energy that shines on the Earth, the ratio between the two is about a factor of 10,000. Now, to put that in perspective, if in a matter of 1 hour of solar radiation, we are able to capture all the energy from the sunlight, it would be dark for that 1 hour. We would be able to power the entire planet for 1 year. So the question is, why are we not doing this? I mean, this is an obvious, clean source of energy. And the question simply boils down to what types of technologies do we have and how much area would we need to cover with it. Now, I say that the ratio is 1 to 10,000. Yes, that's if you average the world and you say, on average, an average consumer of the planet indeed needs a certain amount of energy. In the U.S., we are a little bit more energy spending than most of the other people. Nevertheless, if you look at United States, it's about 1/500th of the energy that shines on the soil of United States. If we could convert that into energy that we can use in running our cars and turning on light bulbs, we would have enough to actually run the entire United States. So we have about 500 times more energy that shines on the U.S. soil than we actually spend. Well, what does that mean? Well, if I have a way of converting solar to electricity, and let me say that I'm going to not be extremely efficient, I'll be 10% efficient in doing this power conversion, I would need to cover about 2% of U.S. soil with solar cells. How big is that? It's about as big as all the roads in the United States. All the rooftops in the United States cover about 3% of the U.S. soil. We spend about 40% of United States soil for growing crops and feeding our stock, right, animals. So our sheep get more land than we do, right? But on the other hand, another statistics you can look at, you can ask, you know, how much soy do we produce? The year escapes me, but somewhere in the mid-90s, we stopped producing quite as much soy as the year before. And the differentiation factor between the 2 years was about 2% of the U.S. land. 2% is not a fantastic amount of land, by any stretch of imagination. Certainly, we can afford it if it's going to save us a variety of other inconveniences when it comes to obtaining the oil and or being able to utilize clean energy. So where is the best place to place the solar cells? Well, it turns out it really doesn't matter much. If you look at the abundance of sunshine, and this is normalized with one being right here in about central United States, well, the eastern part of the United States is a little bit cloudier. Seattle is very cloudy, but eastern part of the United States is a little bit cloudier, and clearly Arizona is less so. But nevertheless, the ratios are not fantastically different. This is all weighted for the amount of sunshine available. The question is then, why haven't we done this already? And it's all in the cost. It's what other energy sources do we have available? And one way of costing the cost, right, is to ask, how much does it cost me to make a certain plant to generate electricity? And how much electricity will I get? How many watts will I get out of it? So the tipping point for any technology stepping into the energy domain is the gold standard set by coal fire plants. And a coal fire plant, roughly speaking, it's about $1 a watt. This is about in 2000 and maybe $0.9 a watt in 2010, which says that if I'm going to go ahead and make a next technology, I better match that. Now, this is a tipping point in the United States where we have a lot of coal. Tipping point in Japan and in Europe are higher numbers. Solar right now, with some of the technologies that are available, the panel cost is on the order of $2 to $3 a watt. There's extra cost for integrating that panel into the grid. But it starts making sense for Japan and Europe to consider implementing solar as an alternative to other ways of producing energy. And consequently, the growth of the solar technology has indeed been quite rapid. The consequence of the growth of the amount of megawatts produced per year, shipped per year, clearly has a significant effect on the price. Now, mind you, this price, as plotted here, as a function of year, is not adjusted for the devaluation of the money as a function of time. Consequently, the rapid degradation is even faster than as you see it right here. Nevertheless, to be competitive, we need to do a couple of things. We need to scale down the cost, and we need to scale up the production. So scaling down the cost means going down by about factor of 4, maybe factor of 10, if you can. Is that doable? Well, look at the past 20 to 30 years. And indeed, you could say that if the trend is exponential or logarithmic, we should be able to get there eventually. Are we going to be able to actually produce enough? Well, we need about 1,000 times more, 1,000 times more solar production than we have today to reach a 1 terawatt number. 1 terawatt is about 30% of the U.S. needs. How long would it take us to get there? Well, you can go ahead and actually plot that. This is the annual production of PVs as a function of time. And these are the actual data points. You can extrapolate those data points. And in about 20 years, we reach about 10% of U.S. needs. In about 30 years, you reach about 100% of U.S. energy needs. This is producing 14,000 acres of solar cells per day. That sounds like an incredible amount of acreage. And hence the question becomes, well, what materials are abundant enough for us to think about making solar cells out of them? And secondly, how do we actually scale up the technology once you identify the material sets? Well, if we keep on making solar cells the way we usually do, which means they're about, let's say, maybe a few hundred microns in thickness altogether, and you can ask how much volume is that to produce 14,000 acres per day, there are only a couple of materials available to us that are abundant enough in the Earth's crust, and that is silicon and carbon. So based on silicon structures, you can say, well, silicon is everywhere. It's in sand. We know very well how to make silicon. Why is silicon not good enough today? Well, the efficiency of polysilicon technology is about 12%. I ask you to have a 10% efficient cells, right? If I could up the efficiency of silicon, I'll be able to down the cost, right? I'll get more watts. So I can get about a factor of 2 if I actually use a crystalline silicon as opposed to polysilicon. Crystalline silicon is kind of hard to make. It costs a lot of money to refine and go ahead and make perfect crystals. Polysilicon is manageable. What people have done in the past is also something called amorphous silicon, which is even more manageable. That is little chunks of silicon that land on the substrate rather than perfect crystals, except you suffer inefficiency. The less perfect the silicon is, the less efficient you get. So the mean, call it, the place to be seems to be, at least at this point, polysilicon. And indeed, we have to come up with ways to do something like this, rolls and rolls of silicon. There's a company called Unisolar that indeed goes and uses stainless steel foils and chemically deposits silicon on top of it, chemical vapor deposition. The only problem is that they're not quite able to reach very reasonable efficiencies. And reasonable efficiency is that 10% benchmark. You want to be able to go ahead and have at least 10% efficient cells to compensate for the fixed costs of frame, of land, of placing an inverter, taxes, whatever else there is to it. You want to have at least that efficient of a cell. There is another way of doing it that's been pioneered at MIT by Professor Ellie Sachs. For his graduate thesis in the late 1970s, Professor Sachs proposed that one way you can grow silicon is simply to have a bucket that's heated, melts the silicon, and through it go through simple wires, ceramic wires. As you pull the wires out, the silicon dries just like a soap bubble between the two wires, and is being pulled out of the hot melt, slowly solidifying. So as you slowly pull the wires, the silicon stays on them and forms this really, really thin film that is known as a ribbon. It happens to be a polycrystalline silicon ribbon. And if you actually do it, and it's done in a place called Evergreen Solar in Marlborough, Mass., you'll actually be able to go ahead and make the ribbon. Here is a number of these furnaces that actually pull the things, and here's a guy holding one of these ribbons. The ribbon is maybe 16 feet tall and about 4 inches wide. And as a consequence of it, it's the cleanest way of making polycrystalline silicon. No dicing, no chemical preparations. Once you have this ribbon, you slice it in 1-foot chunks, you laminate the top electrode, you laminate the bottom electrode, and in a matter of about half an hour to maybe an hour, I've seen the production on a conveyor belt, you get about 12% efficient cells, a very clean way of doing it. Indeed, Germany has recognized this, and the government of Germany has invested significant funds to build a similar plant in Germany that actually doubles the capacity presently available in Marlborough, Mass. This is one of the technologies that today you can say MIT contributed to the advancement of the solar technologies. There are many things that are coming our way, and there are many things that we envision will be the technologies of the future. These we call the disruptive technologies to look at. I said carbon is the other way to go, and indeed there is a great push in considering organic materials, molecular materials, as active ingredients in solar cells. To date, what my laboratory and my colleagues' laboratories have shown is efficiencies of maybe about 3 to 4% power conversion efficiency. Well, that's not fantastically big enough, certainly to help in the production to make it scalable. Well, that depends on how quickly and easily can you put down these films and how thick or thin do you really need them. My assumption was that I needed a few hundred microns of the material. Well, not really. When it comes to nanostructured materials, as produced by chemistry labs of Professor Bawendi or as analyzed by the electron engineering labs of Professor Mark Boldo, these are extremely thin films, submicron in thickness, sufficient, though, in their design to absorb the sunlight, and sufficient in their design to absorb the sunlight that silicon doesn't absorb. Silicon is only 10% efficient or 20% efficient, not because it's not doing a good job. It's doing a great job with all the light that it absorbs. but it does not absorb infrared light, or at least light beyond 1 micron, deep infrared light. And a lot of that light could be reutilized by the nanostructure material sets. In the UV arena, silicon is not very good at all either, because simply it absorbs light too well. Well, this is where organics can help. Through optical downconversion, can actually convert the UV light into green light that silicon can see. These are tricks, Coley, that we can help with, but it's tricks that can actually significantly boost the efficiency of today's silicon cells by a factor of 10% or more. The other types of work that are far-reaching out there is recognizing the fact that plants have actually absorbed light for a couple of billion years, right? And nature has actually spent a fair bit of time refining the plant systems to absorb light fairly well. So looking at that, we can recognize that plants already have fantastically good light receptors in them. The one thing we never thought of doing as electrical engineers, myself being one of them, we never really thought of tapping into biology and saying, well, the bio world already can gather the light. Why don't we take the elements that gather light and go ahead and make solar cells out of them? That is the effort behind Mark Boldo's effort on utilizing bio-inspired materials to make solar cells, specifically spinach. Spinach is fantastic in absorbing light. If you pull out photosystem 1 out of spinach and assemble it as a thin film structure on top of an electrode, place the top electrode on top of it, you'll actually get photoresponse that corresponds to the absorption spectrum of spinach. It's not very efficient today, but we're just starting to tap into the possibility of actually converting, utilizing directly bio-inspired, bio-assembled materials and nanostructure assembling them onto substrates to come up with the next generation of technologies. The other ways to think about it is, well, substrates as we think of them usually are flat pieces of glass. Why so? I mean, much of what we have perfected as a substrate is also fiber. A fiber is underutilized as an electrical substrate. But labs of Professor Joel Fink are considering it as a fabric solar cell type device. Indeed, at this point, they've demonstrated a capability of making fantastic photodetectors for three-dimensional imaging. But at the same time, you can consider making fabrics that are woven out of the photoconductive fibers. And consequently, my jacket or shirt or my tent as I'm camping out would be able to be gathering energy to run my iPod or my PDA or whatever else I happen to have on myself. Indeed, there is a lot of energy around us in the form of light that we happen to not be utilizing it because of the bulkiness quality of the substrates that fibers could provide us to give a very different form. Lastly, I'll mention work of Professor Dan Ossera that was mentioned earlier by Professor Shao Horn. You can directly convert sunlight into chemical energy. And much of it has to do with understanding ways of catalyzing the reaction. That's to say, by utilizing sunlight, you can generate an overpotential that is needed to break up water or other types of chemicals, store the primary chemical components, and then recombine them to go ahead and utilize the afterwards to generate electricity. In essence, you can imagine walking around the desert with a flask that happens to have a solar cell on top of it. The flask would contain water. All you would need to do is just carry it around. It would break up the water, make the gases, recombine them, form electricity when you need it. You can call it an imaginary picture because you worry about storage, and consequently there might be other chemicals you choose beyond just hydrogen and oxygen, as explosive as they might be. Let me just conclude, rather than showing you details of science, I'll just conclude on this picture right here. You can kind of see in faintly. This is a picture of the Earth as viewed from the satellite on the night side of the Earth. So Earth is usually half light, half dark. This one is composite picture, right? But the one thing you can very clearly see is the places that use a lot of electricity, right? Here is United States. It's glowing as bright as a light bulb. Here's Europe. Here's Japan. Very little light in middle of South America or in Africa. Indeed, a great deal of electricity is being utilized by us. It's up to us to figure out ways to generate it back. Another message you can get out of it is that if this is the light you can see out of a satellite, hundreds of miles up above the Earth, that means that we are spending a great deal of energy generating that light, about 25% in U.S. If we can come up with better light bulbs, that's another good thing to do. And consequently, government has done a great deal investing recently in solid-state lighting initiatives, for example. But all in all, maybe a message I'll send you out today is to say that MIT is already making market impact on the solar field. Solar field is rising very, very quickly. The government's investment over the past decade in nanotechnology is starting to pay off and is being seen in a variety of molecular-type designs, nanostructure designs, biological designs that are evolving. The reason why you don't see nanotechnology in the marketplace today is because it takes about 10 years for what we see in a lab to allow to be out there, to be seen as the refined product. So in another decade, I would expect many of the advancements we have already done in the lab will get out there, and within the next decade, we'll also invent the next set of advancements that we'll see in 15 years and 20 from now on. Thank you.
Change positions for this part of it. You've been a patient audience, but Frank asked me to provide some reflections and comments after listening through the two panels, and I thought that I would do that for just a few minutes. I think interestingly, as this is kind of the third session in our series, is to reflect upon actually what was not talked about, just so you have a bit broader perspective, and principally, particularly here in Washington, some of the what I would call buzzwords of the alternative or alternative fuels debate. Biofuels, ethanol, we spent very little time on, which is appropriate in some sense. We spent the last session on that, but it was remarked, and it's certainly an area. And I think the important point of the perspective of not talking about biofuels and ethanol today specifically is that there are many different pathways, particularly those that aren't just ethanol. So ethanol has kind of been put up as the wonder child of a solution set, and we've talked about that being a buffer and being one pathway. The other piece that we did not talk specifically about, and again I think about buzzwords, are flex fuel vehicles. So that in Washington speak typically equates to an E85 capable vehicle. E85, of course, is a vehicle that is allowed to burn up to 85% ethanol as a fuel. And I think that's also interesting to think about that in a perspective of the fact that we talked about many different flexible fuels. We talked about electricity coming from many different places. We talked about hydrogen or fuel cells. We certainly talked about batteries as a fuel source or an energy source. And so I think it adds some very healthy perspective in terms of thinking about certainly technology solutions, the multi-pronged approach that was spoken about this morning. I want to think about three key messages that came out through the day. The first one I think that I want to reiterate here is demand reduction is critical, be that demand reduction through the electric sector or demand reduction in the transportation sector. How does one obtain demand reduction in the transportation sector? We heard about that through VMT changes, through energy efficiency changes, and certainly through alternative technologies. So in that sense, we'll talk about demand of the liquid fuel side of the equation. IC engine improvements will continue, certainly alternative pathways, hybrids. I think the other important point in thinking about demand reduction, particularly in the transportation sector, the key message that came across this morning was broad versus deep, or maybe broad and deep. The transportation sector scale is huge. To improve the efficiency, fuel economy efficiency, of a few vehicles in that fleet doesn't buy you very much as a nation, nor as a world. And so broad and deep are both required, and they both have different time frames as well. I think the other key point in terms of demand reduction that we heard about and we want to think about very, very carefully is price and consumer elasticity. We have all grown up in a world of cheap energy. Our data is from a world of cheap energy. When we go look at price elasticity data and we say, oh, consumers don't respond, it's because when we look historically, we look at a world of inexpensive energy and therefore very inelastic consumption. We don't know what that equation looks like when prices increase. We got a little glimpse of it, particularly in the U.S., when gasoline reached $3 a gallon or a little bit higher than $3 a gallon this past year. SUV sales declined, gasoline prices declined. People looked at alternative transportation modes. That was, I would call, maybe a snippet of what it might look like, but we really don't know. And this is, again, the question of what does technology change bring? What does it take to drive consumer pull in the marketplace? And clearly, and then the second principle message we heard this morning was multi-stranded approaches, alternative fuels, multiple pathways, no single bullet, no silver bullet. I think we have to keep that in mind. We also have to think much more broadly that it's not just liquid fuels. We heard principally about electricity and how that plays in through plug-in electric vehicles and through alternative pathways. And many different, I'll call it carbon neutral pathways as well, be it carbon capture and storage, be it bio-based materials, be it efficient storage of regenerative braking, i.e. dissipative energy pathways. And the third key message, and I think is maybe probably more of a question, which is how do we move this transition? How do we move from the paradigm, the energy paradigm that we grew up in, to a new energy paradigm, where one perhaps is of higher electricity prices, where what classically might be called social goods, the environmental impacts of energy, be that on the environment water side, be it on the greenhouse gas side, how are those monetized? How are those monetized into a specific consumer decision? We heard quite a bit about the value pricing of where early adopters bought hybrid vehicles. But that's not going to translate into the mass consumer market. A couple pieces on transitions, particularly when we think back to the policy environment and of what we're really hoping to help inform that debate on. One, technology maturities and the technologies we heard about today span a variety of, I would call it, maturation. There's everything from basic R&D that will be 10 years out or 15 years out to those technologies which are more mature and available, I'll call it, in the short term. That's an important point to bring forward. The geopolitics are very important. You've been patient through many, many slides, so I'm not going to put up the slide that I was going to put up, but I'll refer to it. It was published in The Economist September 14th, and it was a reference by a Goldman Sachs a piece of research which looked at the future sales of vehicles. And if you can imagine the graph, and I won't put it up, you can think of sales of vehicles in OECD countries basically going on an average of 1% or 2% more per year. It's kind of a flat linear curve. However, when you contrast that to the hockey sticks growth of vehicle sales in India and China, OECD vehicles, fleets in the market will be surpassed by India and China in the next decade. What does that mean? It really means both technology, global challenges, global opportunities, and, of course, the geopolitics. So we have seen many, many instances of, shall we call it, national interests seeking liquid fuels and seeking resources in that sense. And so it brings it back to a political debate. Where we really need to address both the R&D side. Clearly, there's a fair amount of need for continued R&D and continued technology innovation. There's political debate about regulatory decisions domestically. We didn't also mention CAFE standards this morning and how that's promulgated into rules. A fascinating piece of, shall we call it, government push versus consumer pull. In that sense. And we also didn't talk about the fiscal policy piece as well. Tax credits to consumers or to corporations, both on the consumer side of purchasing vehicles, on the corporate side of investing in alternative energies that might be either biofuels or alternative electricity, and clearly foreign policy. It all comes into it. And what we do with our foreign policy clearly impacts our domestic markets and our ability to access resources. So I will end my remarks there just with some reflection and save you some more slides that you don't have to go through. We're going to turn it over to questions. Let me repeat the two simple rules, please. Please identify yourself, and please pose your question as a question. And there are microphones coming around the room.
My name is Martin Apple. I want to thank you for the summary. I want to thank you for the entire gathering and ideas that you brought here. I have 2 points. One is a question about the optimal potential of the Allen-Heger system for photovoltaics. And the other is the thought that MIT, with all its brilliance, should be able to reinterpret the meaning of efficiency and cost, because the net cost isn't just dollars and cents, it's the cost of the environment. And until you work those in those equations, the long-run solutions aren't still here.
So let me address the Allen-Heger solar cells. The solar cells you're referring to are blended polymer solar cells. The challenge of the blended polymer solar cells, there are a number of them, and indeed, it depends how you build them. The blended polymers are quite random in their orientation, assembly, and form. They're very simple to make. You can make them out of simple emulsions. However, the lack of control of the interface is one of those questions that needs to be strongly addressed. The compatibility with metal electrodes is another question that would need to be strongly addressed. The efficiencies, the best efficiencies shown today, independently measured on those cells, are about 8%. What Konark, a company that's actually advancing the solar cells, would say it's on the order of about 5% for a couple of years. And a couple of years, the efficiency might go down to about 4% in a time. So a lot of it has to do with the stability and efficiency of the devices at the present moment. They certainly are not matching the efficiency and stability of the simplest polysilicon-type structures, and consequently the cost, which you would extrapolate from there, has not made them viable to make a significant dent yet in the solar arena.
Other questions? I think back here, if you would, in the back, and then we'll come forward.
Hi, Kimberly Duncan. This morning, Dr. Moniz started out presenting a need for a global portfolio for electrical technologies. And a lot of the technologies that have been presented today are extraordinarily costly and haven't been implemented, or at least wide scale here at home, because of the cost. How can we convince emerging economies abroad to implement these if we don't implement them here at home?
Well, the cost issue really has to put in some context. For example, we did not really discuss coal technologies per se. I mean, how we discussed capture and sequestration. And when it comes to, let's say, coal technologies and the carbon question, we should emphasize that there are, of course, two pathways. Sequestration presumably would be needed in the end for a very, very large scale reduction potentially of carbon dioxide, but we shouldn't forget efficiency. And it turns out that building more efficient plants is not more costly. Indeed, that's why other parts of the world have more efficient coal plants than we do in the United States with our great grandfathering tradition. Now, there are other issues. Mujeeb discussed the nuclear issue. The question of any stated, obviously correctly, that the capital costs are very significant in nuclear, higher than they are for the alternatives, but the operating costs are lower. And when you go to a levelized cost, therefore, it's a very interesting comparison, which depends critically on what your regulatory structure is. How is capital cost recovered, et cetera, et cetera. So the cost equations are complicated. But on top of all of that, I think, comes the other issue we discussed. Do we or do we not internalize other issues like, and going back to Marty's question, environmental questions, and most specifically I will talk about carbon dioxide. If one has a pricing for carbon emissions, the relative costs of these various technologies, of course, is strongly influenced. So until we decide what is a society we want to internalize, until we decide what things like regulatory structures are, and by the way, this was not a policy forum, so we didn't get into the ongoing mess, for example, in terms of how electricity is regulated and the patchwork. There's no simple cost comparison. Those things heavily influence costs. And I would just say that that if we were to internalize some of these costs, the obvious ones like carbon, potentially some security issues as well, we, I think, could see a significant introduction of new technologies. The cost equation would be quite different.
I would like to add just a couple of comments. With regards to nuclear, in a way, we have internalized perhaps the major part of the environmental impact. Namely, we have a tax that's being collected on each kilowatt hour, which is destined to facilitate the building of a repository for the spent fuel. So that's already part of the economics of nuclear. When it comes to trying, however, to expand nuclear to other countries, I think there are obvious advantages to the size of the countries. Those bigger ones will have easier time than the smaller ones because of the size of the plants. The units are more economic when you go to that large size. And the handling of the waste requires also that these smaller countries find a way to group themselves together or perhaps partner with larger countries so that handling of the spent fuel would not become a burden for the smaller countries. So I would say there are many policy issues in that arena as well which will impact the cost of some of the alternatives.
I just had one last comment on that. Mujeed raised the cost of the spent fuel. And I would say this is somewhat facetious, but when it comes to spent fuel and to carbon sequestration, these are areas where we know what it will cost. We just don't know if it will work.
I'll make a comment on solar. I'm not an economist, right? I'm an engineer, and I look at technology. But the one thing I also look at is trends, and the trends that people show in the advancement of the solar technology when it comes to the production, scaling, reduction of costs that people plot indicate that we will be able to be price competitive as a technology in a decade or less, maybe a little more. The question, though, becomes, are we willing to go and take it on? Solar, as is being developed, is in bursts and spurts, right, by few who are interested and those environmentally conscious ones that say, feel that this is the thing to do. But imagine if we actually chose as a country to take this on. We could build a fantastic technology. We could build a fantastic economy based around building solar cells. I mean, to make 14,000 acres of solar cells, that's a lot of employed people. That's a lot of employed people who can provide cheap energy to the world. And imagine what kind of world would it be if we could provide them with a fantastically cheap energy.
I think we have
one more comment, I'm sorry, on that. I just want to note that Vladimir more kind of said it, but once again, go back to the cost question. The issue of even today, with silicon PV, I think there is a bit of a misconception as to how large the cost gap is to delivered retail price of electricity in specific selected markets. If you're in Japan and paying the average 25 cents per kilowatt hour, the gap isn't so big. If you're in Tier 5 California electricity pricing standards, it makes sense right now. So there is this question of as costs come down, it's the question of how the different markets do or do not expand to meet the decreasing cost, not to mention, once again, the potential of a price blip if carbon pricing becomes serious.
Adam Siegel, Energy Consensus. Staying with the solar PV solar for a moment, one of the things, if I price out solar right now in this market, in this area, roughly about 40% of the cost is actually the panels. About 20% is installation. And let's see if it's... Okay, there we go. So going to two questions. One, right now in sort of installation in a home in this area, 40% of the cost is the PV, 20% is installation, 40% is all the other equipment. So if I reduce the PV panels by 50% or increase efficiencies, I'm not, you know, there's a scale, so there's a whole system cost issue to that. Another question is talking about other technologies, nanosolar, perhaps to get your perspective on that as a way to reduce those panels, which I'm suggesting is not such a big amount implication. But also to get your perspective on things like Stirling engine and the other approaches to solar electrical generation.
Sure. So, again, I'm not an economist. But I would, if I look at the cost, and if I look as a layman at costs, cost is very much dependent on how many do you choose to install. If you choose to install one, it will cost you a lot. That first one costs $1 million. But if you choose to install millions, the cost goes way, way down. So installation of many more PV panels, it's not just the cost of a panel that will go down. We would learn how to install them cheaper, and we would learn how to actually put all the other equipment around it that is much more efficient. When it comes to nanosolar, a great deal of promise of the nanosolar is really coming up with entirely different paradigms of capturing light and utilizing it. The benefit of Alan Heger's type technology, at least the excitement of it, was in the fact that it uses emulsion process, things that are used by Kodak and Polaroid to make emulsion films for photography, something we've known for many years, and I guess we're now forgetting because we're firing all the people because of the emergence of a new type of photography. But there are well-known techniques for putting down very thin films over very large areas. You know, every Coke bottle, I like to say, is coated with a thin film of a conductor. I don't know if you knew that. And that is because every time you go ahead and want to label the Coke bottles with a label, they would scuff each other, and when they scuff, they would spark, and they would look very, very ugly unless there was a thin layer of conductor. So for purely aesthetic reasons, we learned how to put large area conductors over very, very, very big plastic substrates, Coke bottles. So if you can now tap into the knowledge base of the food industry that already is vast, you know, and actually apply it towards electronics, that sparks many of our imaginations to say, you know, we might be able to benefit already from the scales that have been implemented. However, if you want to think of it that way, you would have to think about reusable cells. And indeed, Konarka's and Alan Heger cells are interesting in some respect to the Army for short missions, for a couple of weeks. Soldiers who go out there and don't have to carry, they carry about 60 pounds of batteries, right, out of 120 pounds on their back. Half of it is batteries. And if you can get rid of 60 pounds of batteries and put, you know, 1 pound solar cell that will last a couple of weeks, that's very interesting. Similar for camping. You know, there are all these little purposes we can come up with that will allow us to think about using these nanostructured organic or nanosolar quality technologies. I think also realistically, you can come up with ways of boosting the silicon technology. Every percent gained in the efficiency is a significant gain. If you could come up with ways, for example, in utilizing single crystal silicon or coming up with a single crystal silicon that is over large areas, that would be a really good thing. Stirling engines are a fantastic choice as well. The issues become, is it a portable single-user unit or is it a large production plant? Locations of the Stirling engines you have to worry about a little bit. You have to worry about exactly how you put things together and, you know, how do parts wear out, which I do not know enough to give you a sound comment on. But I wouldn't dismiss them, certainly, as compared to the present technologies of silicon. However, the proven true thing that we have today in our pocket and proven true over the past 20, 30 years is indeed PVs based on silicon technology. We can tomorrow make a significant impact if we choose to accept them as the thing we're going to pursue for a while.
Let's take one last question, if you would, please. Do you still have a question? Or?
I was actually
mad. Okay, good. We're great. Ernie, I'd like to offer you an opportunity for short closing remarks, if you're so interested. If not, we can move on. Okay.
Okay. Nothing is planned, but one thing I'll say is, and I'll take off from the at least the use of the word Stirling engine to note that, of course, this was given the time we brought six people here from MIT to discuss these areas. There are many other areas of great interest and which could be highly disruptive. For example, Doug mentioned, you know, an obvious one like biofuels, but here's a less obvious one. Interesting work. Don't know if it'll ever pan out, but the issue of small-scale, Stirling engine-driven micro-combined heat and power. That's a lot of words strung together. But what it says is that, of course, as you know, typically when we have a heat source as coupled to our energy supply, typically a lot of the energy is lost in heat. And if we go to combine heat and power systems, we can get 80-85% efficiency. Typically, that's already done in industry. It's already done at large institutional scale. Suppose we had a kilowatt scale that could actually be in a residential setting. Could be completely disruptive. And there's a lot of work going on that's very interesting. Things like having, we mentioned storage this morning, but if you could have a really significant, inexpensive, quiet, small storage device in your home as opposed to in some utility as the load leveling, very interesting. Lots of possibilities, which goes back to the issue, certainly don't believe any scenario that anybody else or I in particular showed, except notional, that there are a lot of technology opportunities going forward. Let me also add that we'd really appreciate, first of all, NREL and CSIS hosting this meeting. It certainly has helped, in some sense, hopefully, tell people about what MIT is doing, not only in energy specifically, but also in a broad initiative. But I'd like to comment, I think, and end with the statement that certainly MIT is not unique in generating among major research universities really a new focus on the energy problem. There's MIT and there's Stanford and Purdue and Georgia Tech and Colorado and Texas. And this is very interesting. I mean, certainly universities have not been focused on this for 30 years, frankly. I mean, you know, as a major kind of commitment, we believe, and Susan Hockfield alluded to this morning, we believe that this will prove to be a more sustained commitment than, let's say, high gasoline prices will drive. We see in all these places that students are very interested in using the new tools of science that have been developed really quite recently in nanotechnology, in biotechnology, in information technology, in systems understanding and simulation, et cetera. Many of these tools, applying them now to a new generation of technologies in energy. And I think the students are motivated in this because they see this application area of these tools as being at least arguably the preeminent opportunity to really influence quality of life for people across the globe in the next several decades. So I think this is exciting. Hopefully this capture some of that flavor about technology opportunities. But then I know many of you in here are, you may have lost a few of the four-electron transfer reactions every now and then and are interested in policy issues. But again, the other message is we're going to really help a lot in technologies. We're going to work on the policy, but we need to have policy in action if these technologies are going to come in a timely way at scale to address these issues of prosperity, security, and environment in a synergistic way. And thank you for your attention.
So Thank you very much. Let us thank the panel, and I'll also remind you that November 9th will be the next series. So join me in thanking the panel, please.